This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, episode 2, 1963.
Well, Doctor Strange, I did so many years ago, because again, we were looking for something new. And there are so many phony magicians, you know, who do stage acts and so forth and tricks. And I thought, what if we really had a guy who could do magic? Now, the one unusual thing to me about Doctor Strange, when people would try to portray a magician saying, let something happen, they'd usually say, have the magician say, abracadabra. I didn't want to say things like abracadabra. I wanted to make up my own incantations. So I'm quite proud of the expressions I made up. One was, by the hoary hosts of Hoggoth, so let it be. Or by the crystal moon of Sidorok. And it, to me, it sounded very mysterious. He could say those things.
Place to be nation! Welcome back to the second episode of the Marvel Age podcast. By this point, hopefully you have heard episode one. This podcast is, of course, a year-by-year look at Marvel's entire publishing history, dating back to the inception of the Marvel Universe in November of 1961. Our first episode is out there. It covers November of 1961 through 1962. In addition, we've even launched our own very own reaction show as editorial director of digital media. I think I got that right. Ben Morse has taken over with Marvel Age Masterclass, and the first episode of his show reacting to the first episode of our show is out. But as I said, this is our second episode, and for our second episode, we bring back in all their glory the Sarcastic Four, starting with the West Coast contingent, the manager himself, Mr. Todd Weber. Todd, how are you this evening?
I'm doing well. I have recently relocated my podcast studio into my bedroom. So you may not hear the comings and goings of various people in my household, or dogs growling or barking, or you may hear a bird tweet here or there because I am just outside a window. But I hope this is a helpful solution to all of my podcasting foibles here to date.
Absolutely. The Weber family is, of course, the first family of Marvel Age, much like the Fantastic Four. And without the Fantastic Four, we wouldn't have the Sarcastic Four, which brings me to the next member of our panel. He is the Ben Grimm of our show, Mr. Tim Capel.
Nick, I want you to know that I would crawl through a mile of asbestos and scale sheer walls to do this podcast with you.
Well, let's hope for no mesothelioma on your end. But as you mentioned, asbestos, you know, our show would not be complete without our very own Human Torch. Russell Sellers, how are you this evening?
I'm on fire.
Totally, of course you are.
Totally flaming on.
But are you coming like fire is the question.
Yes, always. Always coming like fire. And you can catch me on that first episode of Marvel Age Masterclass with Ben Morris as I come like fire all over the place on that one.
Absolutely. And, you know, I gave Tim and Russell nicknames to draw analogs to the Fantastic Four. So I must go ahead and admit that I am, of course, the Invisible Woman to Todd's Mr. Fantastic, based solely upon the nights we shared together in a Dallas hotel room. I feel that's most appropriate. So that's what we're going to go with. So yeah, here we are, the second episode. Before we get into our subject material, guys, let's take a moment and kind of address some stuff that's happened since our first episode. I don't think any of us saw the response to our first episode coming that wound up happening. We got a pretty big response from both inside Place to Be Nation and outside as well. Seems like we've touched a nerve here. Was this something that you guys were expecting, and were you as taken aback as I was?
Really shocked, genuinely. Shocked in a good way, though. Like, yeah. loved hearing what everybody thought about the show. Was, of course, supremely happy that Ben Morse loved it so much that he wanted to do a reaction show to it. Mm-hmm. And become our very own Chris Hardwick. So, yeah, it's, man, what a ride it's already been, and we've only gotten one of these in the can so far.
Yeah.
I am personally overwhelmed by the fact that a couple of the wrestling diehards from Place to Be Nation are actually reading comics because of this show, or in part because of this show. So that's quite the achievement, I would say.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy too, because I feel like we've recommended, you know, on our various podcasts, lots of more modern access points into comics. But I think there's something about coming from that wrestling background where you want to build these in-depth chronologies and continuities. And so I think taking it all the way back to the beginning was perhaps more appetizing to some of those, some of our wrestling compatriots. Tim, what about you? What's the response been like on your end?
I would have to concur. I've been really taken aback by the response we've gotten outside of the usual circles, you know, not just Place to Be Nation comics, Place to Be Nation wrestling, certainly very surprising, but folks I've not actually had the opportunity to interact with to this date. So that's been pretty cool to me. And I'm just wondering if our progression on this podcast might mirror the progression of the Marvel Universe itself, where we're sort of feeling things out and surprised by our own response. Not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but we could really be tapping into something here that I think people are interested in, and I hope we can really serve their interests and live up to whatever expectations they might have for a show like this.
Absolutely, and you give me the perfect segue, as you mentioned, kind of finding our way through this show, the way, much like Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and those early collaborators were doing with the early days of the Marvel Universe. So before we launch into our subject material, let's kind of, you know, 61 into 62, I think we all kind of agreed last time, was a year that saw a lot of ups, but also its requisite share of downs. So what were you guys kind of looking for out of this reading list? What were you guys kind of expecting coming into 1963? Were you expecting major jumps in terms of quality for certain titles? Were there any new character debuts you were especially looking forward to diving into?
I didn't really feel like there was going to be much of a jump in quality, because as we've seen in modern comics, even whenever you're like drastically changing things from year to year, you don't normally see like major shifts in terms of quality. Like it's usually kind of comparable. Like that kind of change is slow. And I didn't figure that was going to be the case, or wouldn't be the case for 1963. As far as like major debuts, I was really looking forward to some new villains coming in, because I knew that 63 is a big year for that. Mm-hmm. Particularly on the Spider-Man end. But what I found most surprising was that there was indeed a jump in quality. Maybe not to the degree that I'm going to suddenly become like a big fan of certain series, but
I think I know the one you're referring to.
Yeah. Mm. But when you look at the comparison of the previous year to this one, it is pretty noticeable. There's a stark contrast between the two, most notably in art quality.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think we kind of mentioned that in the first episode, that Jack Kirby in particular, it felt like, didn't really start to give his best work, or maybe not his best work, but more focused work until towards the end of the year. And so coming into 1963, I think for me personally, I was expecting something of a jump in quality, at least in terms of Jack Kirby's art. And also, you know, I had kind of gone through this project in a very limited degree myself as a personal project a few years back. And so I knew I was looking forward to some of the early Doctor Strange stuff, which we'll, of course, get into a little bit later. But Todd, what were you kind of looking for coming into this one?
I was looking forward to the universe converging, to seeing how these parts play with each other. And you get that definitely in the pages of Fantastic Four, in the pages of Amazing Spider-Man, and a little bit later when some of the team books show up. So that's what I was excited about, was seeing how the characters go from their own books, their own stories, their own villains, into interacting with other creations of Stan and Jack and Steve Ditko.
Absolutely. Tim, your thoughts coming into this one?
Yeah, similar to that. It's kind of like the second half of the superhero foundations of the Marvel Universe. So in our debut episode, we got the first appearances of Fantastic Four, of the Hulk, of Ant-Man, of Spider-Man, of Thor. Again, one of these things not like the other, but you know, it's like, okay, what about the rest of them? So it's just one episode later, we're getting to meet the X-Men, the Avengers debut, Doctor Strange, Iron Man in here. So you've got that, plus you have the continuation of some of those previous concepts we've already been introduced to. So primarily, I was looking forward to not just the additional debuts, because most of those I've already read and become familiar with in some form or fashion already, but like Fantastic Four has kind of found its footing now, mm-hmm. so it makes for an easier read. Of course, you've got Spider-Man moving into a series proper, so things like that. You mentioned Doctor Strange as well, not only a debut, but the way that is done is somewhat unique, which we'll get into.
Absolutely. Well, no better time in the present to dive right into our reading list for 1963, and no better place to start 1963 than where we started with our first episode, and that's of course with the first family of Marvel, the Fantastic Four, as we dive right into January of 1963 and Fantastic Four number 10. I believe this one, somebody help me out, did this feature the return of Dr. Doom to the pages of Fantastic Four? I believe
it did. Pretty surprising return, honestly. It kind of seemed back and forth, or at least the tease on the cover makes it seem like you've got this this Reed Richards heel turn.
Yes.
Which could have been a fun thing, and that's not entirely an untrue tease from the cover. But as we get into this one, you start to see that it's going to be a Doctor Doom story, and not a bad one. It's actually got I found this plot to be somewhat interesting, if there were also some unique situations within the panels of this one.
You've got that trademark Stan Lee, Jack Kirby fourth wall breakage right from the cover here, too.
Yeah.
I mean, to Ben Morris's point about how innovative Fantastic Four was in doing things that you didn't see from other superhero team comics, here we go. Prime example. This is downright Morrisonian for the 1960s.
Yeah, so the conceit is that Stan and Jack are chronicling the real-time, real-life adventures of the Fantastic Four. But we all know that they're in our world, our Earth Prime, if you will. And Dr. Doom comes and decides to, I don't know what you say, influence the FF lays a trap for them through Stan and Jack.
Right.
Which is just nuts. I mean, like, it is like Tim said, it's very Morrisonian, but, you know, it's weird that I don't really know of anybody that pulled that trick in between Stan and Jack and Morrison doing it with, I guess, what was it, Animal Man much later on. I mean, I know you had the two company creators reference each other in stuff like, oh, what was it, Todd? You can probably tell me, the old Halloween-themed issues that both companies used to do were always focused around this very specific Halloween parade in this one, like, small right. town. Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
The Rutland Halloween.
There you go.
Unofficial crossover.
Night of the Reaper is probably the most famous story that features that parade. And that always confused me when I was a kid reading that story.
So it was like a contingent of, like, I don't know, New England-based writers that came up with this idea. I think it's Rutland, Vermont, right, that I'm thinking of, that has this famous Halloween fair every year, and you know, everybody kind of it was like an in joke that unless you were really in the know, especially as a fan, you didn't realize that this was supposed to be the same event that characters from both companies were, you know, in attendance for.
Right. And I guess, I mean, that's the only other thing I can think of like that. But even then, comics creators themselves didn't play an active role in the story. So this really is remarkable that they did this so early on. I mean, 10 issues in is not like they've built a ton of cachet with the audience. Yes, it's a runaway success, but I thought it was really cool that they were able to pull this off.
And can we also point out that there were some other, like, just strange moments in this issue right from the jump. Like, you got Mr. Fantastic trying to take a picture of Sue while she's invisible. Mm-hmm. And he refers to his process as a vibralite. And my first thought was, well, so that's what a superhero vibrator would be.
Why do you need a superhero? You're Mr. Fantastic. And anyway, so
I was going to say, bring on the Mr. Fantastic jokes.
I figured it was just a brand name. And then just a few panels later, they're out in public and having their own celebrity moments, like just being ambushed by people. And then Sue Storm gets yet another Me Too moment with this random dude who's trying mm-hmm. to like feel her up on the street.
Hands off. Get lost. Repulsive.
Oh God.
Yeah. So when she's visible, she's basically being groped and told to smile, which this person literally does. And her answer to that is to become invisible and flee. So I don't know. Would it be too much to say that there's perhaps some kind of metaphor in the idea that this woman must become invisible and that she makes contributions to this team in the capacity of an invisible woman, yeah, quite literally and figuratively? No shortage of think pieces on that. Understandably,
perhaps could be something of a response to, I know Ben talked about on Masterclass and called us out for kind of not drawing the favorable comparison for Fantastic Four to the Justice League of America stories of that time. And I can tell you, as someone who's read a lot of those books, Wonder Woman was very much the Invisible Woman of those stories, and not in a positive, like, no. Not in a meta self-referential kind of way. She was like, there were scenes of her literally being told to clean the clubhouse and stuff. So, you know, this whole Invisible Woman bit could very much be a response to the usage of Wonder Woman around this time.
I could definitely see that, especially since the part where she turns invisible to run away from this dude, she winds up causing a car accident. And it's it's like, man, the metaphor that Stan and Jack are injecting into this might have been lost on kids, but reading it as an adult, you're like, this is kind of hard to miss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A couple other random things that caught my eye from this one that I just wanted to call out. Was this the one where Alicia Masters was building the various puppets for the Fantastic Four?
All the rogues sculptures. Gallery.
Where I was almost convinced that she had to be a sighted supervillain who was playing all of them for fools because of the sheer amount of detail that she put into this. I'm like, there's no way. No fucking way. She's got to be a supervillain.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable. And then also a random panel and like, I think it's like page 17 if you guys are looking along, where Kirby draws Reed Richards doing the Dr. Doom laugh. It's one of the most visually disturbing and haunting things I think I've seen. I don't know, for whatever reason, that panel just like made me shudder. I was like, that is creepy and off-putting, and it has a very like pedophilic look about it for some reason. So I don't know. It just jumped out to me upon first reading.
You also get yet another strange alien race never to be seen again.
The ovoids, right?
The ovoids, yeah. Who have mastered cloning, and so Dr. Doom steals their plot. But I do really appreciate how Kirby drew Reed possessed by Doom, always very twisted. One eye bigger than the other with the eyebrow. You know, it was obvious to us. You could tell what's going on. So, and I enjoyed the story quite a bit. There's something to be said for these full-length stories when most of the other output we're reading from Marvel at this time is a half of a book, maybe.
That's actually a great point, Todd, and an excellent transition into our next the next entry on our reading list. And just for posterity's sake, or for posterity, that doesn't even make any sense. Just for simplicity's sake, we're going to include this as one entry, as we read for this year the first three issues of Amazing Spider-Man. And I know right out the gate that Russell is chomping at the bit to talk about these. So let's just go through these real quick. Amazing Spider-Man 1-3. I got to say, right from the jump, Russell, you'll probably agree with me. I think this book found its footing very early on. And yes, it's got some lulls at various points, but it's pretty high quality consistently across everything we read this year.
You said it, Bubba. This is my book. This is a fully realized character, very much in the vein of the Spider-Man that you all know and love. And this makes me appreciate the work of Stan Lee and Steve Ditko that much more, because they had their character figured out from the jump. And every Spider-Man writer and artist who's come since, while maybe putting their own spin on it, you can tell that they read all of this and are playing directly off of it. This is the definition of influential work. And not just that, but you get fully formed, like other characters that are debuting in these three issues come out almost fully formed. J. Jonah Jameson makes his debut in Amazing Spider-Man number one, and he is very much the JJJ that you know and love. He was a real highlight for me through these three issues. And I also really appreciate that, to my point about Amazing Fantasy 15 being something of a supervillain origin story, Stan Lee keeps playing with that theme. He keeps showing us Peter Parker struggling with the idea of committing criminal acts, using his powers for personal gain, even though it really wouldn't be just for his personal gain. It would be to help his Aunt May, who is now in dire straits due to the death of Uncle Ben, to the point where she's like pawning off jewelry, and he's thinking, oh, well, it'd be so easy. I could just go steal money and nobody would even know I was there. But then it occurs to him, what would Uncle Ben think of me if I did that? So Peter's better nature wins out. And I'm like, I really appreciate all this. And on top of that, Steve Ditko in these three issues and in some other work that we're going to talk about later, for my money, has surpassed Jack Kirby in this year. Steve Ditko is my guy.
Yeah, he's fantastic in these issues. I mean, but Todd alluded to something that's a little interesting. Unlike Fantastic Four, which featured full-length stories, for these first couple issues of Amazing Spider-Man, they choose to go with a main feature and something of a backup. It's maybe not fair to call it that, because it's kind of more split directly in the center. So I guess just two kind of equally linked features. But I think that's an interesting approach, because Fantastic Four was not doing that. The few issues of Incredible Hulk we read weren't doing that. So while this book has its own star character, they're still going with the shorter approach, you know, more concise early on. How did that read for you guys, Tim?
Well, it allows them to cover a lot of ground and not a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. It's when you look at, you know, we covered the first three episodes of Amazing Spider-Man, but it's really six stories total because of the split nature of that series. And it's kind of like what you would find as installments within one of the anthology books, where, you know, think back to some of the early Thor that we read, certainly Amazing Fantasy as well, with Spider-Man's debut. These were like 15-page stories, basically, and they didn't feel short by any means. It was just the way that they were paced. They were 15 pages of story within those anthologies. Well, even within his own series, we're getting kind of that split book treatment. It's just the other half of the book is another Spider-Man story. And I don't know, it just felt like a way that they were packing a lot in. And, you know, you get the introduction to, as Russell said, J. Jonah Jameson. We see more of Aunt May and her plight as well.
Her plight being that she's just so unnaturally old.
Yeah, somehow she's hanging in there. And I guess Uncle Ben didn't leave much in the way of an insurance policy to take care of his loved ones after he was gone. But no matter. We have also the kind of maybe first, is it the first crossover in the emerging yes. Marvel Universe with the Fantastic Four, that second yeah, story.
The mm-hmm. first time they acknowledge that these characters exist in the same universe. In fact, that's the first time in Marvel that they actually do that.
Although, technically, does that even count, seeing as how it was Peter Palmer that the Fantastic yes. Four, and not Peter Parker?
And he's also referred to as Superman at some point.
In one, yes, he one is. Panel in
issue one. I do
I did love seeing Ditko draw the FF. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I did notice that by issue 3, they do go full length. So we did the Doc Ock origin or the Doc Ock story introduction.
That's true. That was a full length. I forget that.
But what's interesting is, you know, in these first three issues, we get introductions to villains that are still around and playing roles to this day. I mean,
yes.
The Chameleon is probably one of the lesser known, but he's there in that first issue. The second issue, I believe, has both the Vulture and the Tinkerer. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then issue 3 has got Doc Ock. All old men all the time. It really is kind of incredible. A book after Todd's own heart. So there you go.
And yet another alien race that has already invaded Earth. Never seen again.
That was especially weird because, like, my only exposure to the Tinkerer is in the very modern context where he's just a dude that builds stuff. And here, he's, like, in league with this alien race. And the implication is that he is himself an alien, I think, at one point. But it's clearly later retconned. Yeah.
It was a weird kind of story. I dug it, but it might have been the one in this particular set of issues where I kind of side-eyed the whole thing a little bit there towards the end.
That's perhaps true, but I think for me, the weakest one, because there's two in issue 1, two in issue 2, and then, of course, you got the full length in issue 3. I think the weakest one for me was probably the first one, honestly, because it focuses a lot on John Jameson, who is a character, especially in the modern context, has kind of been relegated to something of a throwaway character. He's only called upon in very rare circumstances, and there's not really a ton done with him these days. Whereas the other ones all felt like they are still relevant today, if that makes some level of sense.
Yeah. And I personally appreciated, and I can even appreciate it so much more now, some of the origin stories for these characters. Like the origin of Doc Ock was the first time that I really felt like, okay, they're showing us a really tragic character and giving us an explanation for why he's acting the way he is. They actually referenced that he has brain damage in the story. So I was like, oh man, he is now a tragic figure, and his monologuing and the way that he carries himself, his planning and everything, that hasn't really changed all that much since 1963 into the modern day. Maybe his plans have gotten just a little bit more sophisticated, but he still feels very much like the same Otto Octavius that we've always known. The only maybe weird thing is that everyone just calls him Dr. Octopus. Almost no one calls him Octavius except for the narrator. Mm-hmm. And that is a common theme, as a common thing throughout the entire story. But I'm glad that Todd pointed that out, that this goes to a full-length series, but as you'll notice, I think in this year, these stories slowly start to drop the chapter divisions as well, and start to go towards more full-length stories. And even in one case, we have some direct carryover that maybe was our first example in Marvel of a story that was part of a larger arc that continued from one issue to the next.
Absolutely. You know, I think part of that is probably just a natural effort on, you know, Stan and Jack and Steve's part to slowly initiate the reader into this new form of storytelling. Because as we touched on last month with Amazing Adult Fantasy, so many of these books were anthology driven and readers were accustomed to shorter form storytelling. So now to give you these big sprawling issue-length epics, which, yes, I said sprawling, and it may seem silly, but, you know, in the modern era of written for the trade to consider 32 pages sprawling, but by the standards of the time, these were lengthy, deep stories that people were not accustomed to seeing on their store shelves. So I think perhaps that chapter thing is just an attempt on their part to ease the reader into this new era rather than throwing them in feet first.
Yes.
And it's even jarring for me as someone who has read comics for most of my life, when you compare it to, as you said, the way things are sort of paced for the trade today, written for the trade. These Silver Age 1960s comics decidedly are not, and I don't know, to put it in somewhat succinct terms, let's just say it takes a good 30 minutes to read one of these comics cover to cover.
Oh, they're dense, yeah.
And I mean, and that's fine. It's just if you're thinking, oh, I'm going to just blow through some comics like you typically can you know, with your monthly stack that you pick up today. You can't really do that with these. It's not because they're bad or hard to get through. It's just they're very, very dense. They stick to a pretty traditional layout in terms of the panels per page. You get anywhere from 6 to 9 panels. That's pretty straightforward. But that in and of itself is, I mean, the fact that you don't really see deviation from that, you're already setting yourself up for a dense read. But what goes on within those panels is quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's text heavy. Granted, not Chris Claremontian by any stretch, but still, I mean, Stan had a lot to say and a lot to convey in these stories. So you got your 12 cents worth and more, I would think.
Yeah. And do you think part of that is perhaps the pressure that Stan was putting on himself to wrap these up in one issue? Because as mm-hmm. Russell alluded to earlier, as we go along here, we're going to start to see more carryover from issue to issue, and they become, while they're still fairly self-contained, they gradually start to become less and less self-contained as we go along.
Yes. I'm not quite ready to leave Spider-Man behind just yet here.
Right.
Just a couple of things I think we should remark upon is, you know, we have Moose as kind of the proto Flash Thompson.
But jump back and forth. At one point he is uh-huh. Flash, then he's not Flash. Flash, you know, which one is it? Make up your mind, Stan.
I wonder if that was an Archie Comics thing, like, because their big hulking character, dumb jock dude, was Moose. And so I wonder if the folks at Archie said, hey, Stan. So I think that was maybe a change that happened. You also just had these kind of patterns where Peter decides, I can't make it, you know, and everybody makes fun of him. You see this formula kind of get exploited or used very frequently. You also had with issue 3 so many arcs, though, happening. You had the character mm-hmm. lose for the first mm-hmm. time and get humbled and then had to push himself a little bit further and get inspired by the Human Torch doing a talk at his school, of all things.
Which was maybe one of the silly. It was one of the most silly, awesome moments of the series so far. But it totally fit in keeping with the times and with the themes that Stan and that Steve had been playing with.
And that's one. Todd touched on one thing that I want to, you know, circle back to here for just a second. You mentioned how Peter at various points throughout this, very early on through these first 3 issues, is questioning himself and wondering if he can go on because things are just so bad for him. To this point in superhero comics, had we seen a hero with as much like crippling self-doubt as Peter Parker? I mean, it's really remarkable mm-hmm. in that regard.
And that's, 'cause
if you read any of the early DC stuff from this same time frame, there's none of that here.
And that's going to be talked about at the next masterclass, is how different these comics are. Relatable problems, things that you identify with in these characters, and that hadn't been done. Peter struggles to make money every month.
Yeah, and on that note, the ending of the first story in issue 1, it leaves our protagonist in a worse place than he started in. Not only has he failed to make the money, that's the central problem of the issue, right? That Aunt May is flat broke. She's pawning her jewelry. So Peter is trying to find all these various ways to capitalize on his abilities and to make money. And he's just rebuffed at every turn. He ultimately does not solve that problem. And on top of that, the bad guy gets away. Well, the bad guy doesn't get away. They get the kingpin, but it was through really not a lot. The kingpin, the chameleon, through not a great contribution on the part of Spider-Man. So yeah, you get that kind of he's still learning the ropes, the rookie superhero, that, you know, that development is going to be tracked throughout this series. So that's a thread that Stan seems very, very interested in exploring.
And
two more things I want to throw.
Hero,
go ahead, Todd.
Will he be a hero? Will he be a villain thing kind of dangling mm-hmm. at the end of issue 1?
Yeah, because this guy has legit like financial woes hanging over his head, and so there's always that temptation for him to turn to a life of crime, which makes it altogether compelling here early on. Two more random things that I want to throw out. One, I want to circle back around and agree with Russell. That whole Doc Ock issue three is outstanding from That's beginning amazing. To end. Just remarkable. Everything about it, from the way they develop Dr. Octopus himself to the way Peter Parker is that issue, it's just great. And two, you guys fill me in. What is Now Magazine, and how much of a role did it play later on? Because that threw me for a complete loop.
I'm with you there. I was just thrown by that. I was like, what the hell is Now Magazine? And I guess it doesn't matter because it disappeared by the next issue and we're back at Daily Bugle. So, all right. That was much like Peter Palmer. Maybe we stepped into an alternate universe at some point and seeing another version of Spider-Man.
I'm going to speculate that since we're trying to justify Peter taking so many photos, this was perhaps their way to say, okay, well, newspaper only run one or two photos. Here's a reason J. Jonah would really need all these pictures is because he's putting out this full color glossy thing. That's purely conjecture on my part.
Well, here, I'll take that to the next level, Todd. We've always known J. Jonah Jameson as something of a tightwad, but Peter makes reference to being able to buy like brand new house appliances for Aunt May with his paycheck from Now Magazine. J. Jonah paid Peter so much that Now Magazine went out of business, and thus he refused to ever pay him that much again, which led to the whole long-standing like Peter Parker's being screwed over by the Daily Bugle and J. Jonah Jameson thing because he's still angry that Now Magazine went out of business as a result of Peter Parker.
But that I'm glad you brought that up because
I think Todd and I need to share a no prize for that.
True believer. He just won no prize, but I'm not supposed to make fun of Ben's friend Stan, so I will not.
We are at some point going to get Ben Morse's Stan on the record. It's going to happen at some point or another. He's going to record too many of these to not do it, and we're going to stand by our stands from the first episode.
Well, yes. I'm plenty proud of the one thing I did get out of him at the end of this last or the first episode. So if you guys haven't heard that, go listen to it. It's something. But did we notice that also that Peter apparently paid Aunt May's rent for an entire year off of that one paycheck in addition to all the appliances? So should that maybe not be a plot point, at least for a few issues?
It probably should have been, but you know, Jonah, was this bi-monthly at the time?
I think so.
It was still bi-monthly. So there you go. Maybe he would lose it all in the stock market and return to the status quo. Last thing I have is you still have the space race elements. You still have kind of the looming communist threat and a lot of pseudoscience.
Oh, for sure. This is very much a Cold War comic like all the way, even though the Fantastic Four steer much harder into it than Spider-Man does. Even this type of story is not immune to the Red Scare of the 1960s.
Absolutely. Tim, do you have any final thoughts on Spider-Man before we move forward?
Just that I absolutely love the conceit of Peter stumbling into this win-win situation of peddling photos to Jameson. So to him, he's not only making money, but sticking it to the guy that's given him so much grief. And yet, Jonah is totally oblivious to this. So he's really kind of making Jonah out to be a moron who, as you mentioned, is not so miserly yet in how he compensates his young freelancer here.
So, God, and you bring up J. Jonah Jameson being miserly. And that's one thing we didn't touch on that I'm even afraid to like delve into this early on, but do we need to talk about how the media is treating Spider-Man perhaps as a reflection of Steve Ditko's feelings on general society?
It may be premature for that.
Okay.
I think it just serves the story at this point.
Yeah, it's just I wasn't picking up on it quite that hard, so I'm thinking service to the story, but I think probably by issue 10 of this series, it may be too much to ignore.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say one thing you sort of have to infer because it's not explicit in the story itself is that Spider-Man's treatment is different from that of the Fantastic Four because he is a vigilante with a secret identity. They are public figures. And you don't see really, I don't think any other masked vigilantes running around at this point in the Marvel, the Manhattan of the Marvel universe.
And speaking of that comparison, how funny was Spider-Man's quote unquote tryout for the Fantastic Four?
Yeah.
Nonprofit.
Yeah, he was like, well, I'm done here.
Yep.
You mean to tell me the Baxter Building is nonprofit? That's a big load of horseshit from Reed Richards, if I've ever heard any. But I think we've covered Spider-Man pretty well, so let's move on to the first of our brand new character debuts, as we covered Tales of Suspense number 39. And this, of course, features the debut of Tony Stark, a.k.a. Iron Man. And this is I'm struggling to find the words to how I want to talk about this one, because on the one hand, I think it's actually, from a plotting perspective, pretty well done. I think it's a tense narrative. I think the art is really well done. I think Stan, even though he's being a bit bombastic here, is playing it perhaps a bit more seriously than he does with some of his other characters. But man, it's hard to get around the over-the-top Asian stereotypes throughout this issue, is it not?
Oh, this one doesn't age well.
No, it does and it doesn't, though. Like, I don't want to throw it completely under the bus for that. I understand it's problematic, and I understand it's offensive. I get all that. But I think there are some really solid story bits in between all that, and I don't want those to get lost in the shuffle, you know?
I'll agree with that, especially for the character of Tony Stark, who, as we all know, we've all been critical of that character in the comics for a long time, pre-RDJ, and as having like no personality or not really having something for us to really latch onto. But in reading this story, I started to kind of see some of those flashes of the RDJ version of the character coming through, like a 1960s iteration of him. But still, it is a little bit there. And I found him to be a bit more compelling than I at first thought he might be. But I do have to say that as this story goes along, it becomes a bit stock superhero origin. It starts to feel like, all right, I feel like I've read this already within this project that we've been doing. Doesn't feel like it's like really breaking the mold or anything, and some of it is, you know, stretching beyond itself, if that makes any sense. Like it's really stretching to try and get its own footing and its own plot straight and to keep it interesting as well. So that's where the struggle is, but do have to call out that the artwork on this is actually pretty good. Don Heck draws this one. He is the co-creator of Iron Man. And the script from Larry Lieber is not too bad at all. That's where some of the, unfortunately, the racism comes in when he starts speaking in broken English for his Asian characters. Yeah. But Don Heck's art really does work for me in these issues. Even though, as we were talking about earlier, about some of these books being text heavy, this one really is at times. But somehow, he like very strategically places the text around his characters to keep it from like taking away from the art. So I was reasonably impressed with this, if a bit undersold or underwhelmed by the overall like character directions, especially I think the one part that really bugs the hell out of me is when Tony Stark is in the middle of his escape and has an existential crisis. I'm like, maybe get away first, then have your emotional breakdown. But that's neither here nor there by the end.
That was foreshadowing for Iron Man 3 and his convenient panic attacks.
So maybe it's actually been a thing in the comics for from the jump for Iron Man, is he has these weird existential crisis moments that occur at the most inconvenient possible time.
Well, let's just be thankful there was no annoying kid here in this first issue that would have made us never want to read Iron Man ever again. Tim, or actually, let's go to Todd. Todd, you know, I talked about it a little bit. I wound up liking this one, but how do you reconcile? I mean, this is easily of these stories we read this year, I think it's the most conflicting one for me personally. How were you able to, where did you fall on this one? Were you able to reconcile some of the more, quite frankly, offensive elements with some of the story that's in there?
No, I had a hard time with it.
Okay. Fair enough.
Had a feeling.
You know, just the phrase red gorilla Wong or Wong Chu. No, the yeah. Wong Chu, the red gorilla tyrant.
Tyrant, yes.
I'm going to write a song. Wong Chu, the red gorilla tyrant. We're going to...
And we have a jingle.
We do, we don't need a jingle for this show. Anthony Stark for most of this issue. Actually, all of this issue. So he's Anthony Stark. Yet again, another scientist. Every hero to this point, with the exception of the other three in the Fantastic Four. Fantastic Four, you have Reed Richards. Bruce Banner, scientist. Hank Pym, scientist. Peter Parker, science student. Anthony Stark, millionaire scientist. seems that there's a pattern here with the heroes of the Marvel Universe. The art is really good, particularly in faces. I have to wonder if Heck did a lot of photo referencing for this, because it is different. It's very nice to see a different artist when we've had almost everything be Kirby or Ditko at this point. But yeah, the racial caricatures, even Professor Yinsen, take me out of this very badly, unfortunately.
I got you. That was one thing that was surprising to me, though. I had assumed, having not read any early Iron Man, that the character of Yinsen was a creation solely for the movie. But no, he's right here in the first appearance. So that was kind of cool to see. Tim, I'm guessing I'm probably the only one who is even trying to justify some of this a little bit.
You know, actually, you made a point of emphasizing the tension in this story. And I did write down in my notes a little bit flippantly, but still, this is like the grim and gritty version of a Silver Age superhero comic.
It really is. Yeah.
I mean, just from a plot standpoint and...
I mean, let's consider the origin for a moment. Whereas the Fantastic Four are given, you know, they have these cosmic rays that come along and they definitely alter their lives, but they're able to go on living. Spider-Man, the same thing. The Hulk, the same thing, even though you can say that half his life has been taken away from him. Hank Pym has lost nothing as by virtue of his transition. But Tony Stark, his origin story is that either he is Iron Man or he might die. Like that is, and to me, that is the most... Those are the biggest stakes that have been introduced in one of these early stories that we've seen thus far to this point.
And Russell kind of drew the line between this version of Tony Stark and movie RDJ. And when you think about it, the plot itself, I mean, very, very, very broad strokes of the plot does translate to that 2008 movie. And I think that... this issue, in a weird way, fares both better and worse and by comparison to the movie, because on the one hand, you see, oh, well, there was some potential to this. Like, there is a basic arc here that works, and that's good, but it also really holds a light up to the extremely unfortunate racist caricatures, and my God, to Wong Chu, thanks for everything, Larry Lieber.
Well done, Tim.
That's unfair. I shouldn't lay this at Larry Lieber's feet, but
no, it's at Stan Lee's. Yeah,
you want to talk about product of its time? This one, there's really no excusing it looking back, but I do get that. Okay, the idea is sound.
Yeah, I will say for this one, ultimately, it does what that early Tales to Astonish issue in 1962 couldn't do, in that I was actively looking forward to reading whatever our next Tales of Suspense entry is on the reading list, whereas Tales to Astonish had me dreading reading any more Hank Pym. So, you know, at least this inspired me to carry forward.
I'll agree. Yeah, it had the inverse effect for character. And luckily, sometime down the road, when Marvel's sliding timescale takes effect, this origin actually winds up retconned out, and we get a more updated version, though probably not that much less racist.
Yeah, Sandin, this is clearly supposed to be Vietnam, but
oh yeah,
those are not Vietnamese names. they're kind of cross-culturally Asian.
Specifically, it says it's South Vietnam, that the Red Guerrilla tyrant Wong Chu is the, I guess, warlord of. So this,
which makes very little sense,
is all over the place. Absolutely. But fortunately, we will not be continuing to reside in this setting and doing these types of stories with Iron Man.
Well, until the Mandarin comes along.
The Mandarin is a whole other bag of cats.
We will cross the Mandarin Bridge when we get there. But I think we've talked to Iron Man here. We've addressed the many problems that are inherent in his original origin story. Well, let's jump back over to the Fantastic Four for a moment and talk. For whatever reason, like I said, we should throw this out there. We didn't mention it up front. These reading lists that we're reading through are all provided to us by the wonderful Dave Busing over at Comic Book Herald. I actually gave a little fundage to his Patreon account. If you want custom reading lists built for you, if you go donate, I believe it's $5 a month to him, he will build you your very own reading list for monthly reading. I figured, based on us doing the show, it was only right that I throw a little cash his way each month. So big shout out to Dave and him being able to provide these reading lists to us. But for whatever reason, he has, as our next entry on the reading list, Fantastic Four 12, 13, and Annual 1 all lumped together as one story. So here in 12 and 13, we are right back to Dr. Doom, is it not?
Well, 12 has a lot of introductions. We get the Red Ghost and
excuse me, I got 12, 13, and 16, 17 mixed up. My bad, guys.
That's okay.
Can't take it away because I'm doing a shitty job of hosting tonight.
Yeah, 12 is Hulk.
Hulk and the Thing for the very first time. I'm so sorry, guys. Yeah, please continue.
And the I forget the name of the villain who reveals himself as Bruce's underling, but that's what's unique about this is because you're waiting for the whole issue for Hulk and Thing to square off, and finally do.
That was a pretty good fight, of course, yet another pretty forgettable villain here, the Wrecker, who I don't think has been used since. He was a Carl Cort. He is,
which was interesting because me, being a massive Thor guy, I read the Wrecker and I go, oh, there must be some kind of connection to the Wrecker crew, but no, absolutely not. Just the Wrecker.
They reuse the name for the crowbar wielding Wrecker later.
And for the record, this is issue 12, not 13 yet.
Is issue 12, and I also found yet more silly happenings to call out here, how they're on a military base in their pursuit of Hulk, who has been wrecking missile silos. And while they're there, Reed Richards, basically the entire Fantastic Four, just take it upon themselves to take over this rocket sled project, much to the chagrin of the generals in charge, who are like, how in the hell did you even get your hands on this? Who told you could do this? And they're like, relax, we got this. We're going to fix it up for you. Yeah, because that's the thing they'll let civilians do, even in the 60s. So, just some fun little silly shenanigans that the Fantastic Four get themselves into that was both kind of odd to me, but oddly entertaining at the same time, especially Reed Richards blowing himself up into a trampoline to catch a thing as this car disintegrates.
We also see, I don't even know how to describe this, but it's a recurring motif throughout this series in particular that I've noticed. And maybe this speaks to how it is it's always described as a book-length epic, right, where this is always 22 pages of story. But you'll have these little breaks in the plot where characters will describe things they're going to do or want to do, and it's illustrated throughout a series of panels, and it's kind of like the comics equivalent of a rest hold in a wrestling match, in a way. Because there's an example of this, we get each of the four members of the Fantastic Four saying what they will do individually to stop the Hulk, and they go into great detail explaining that, which Drac draws quite beautifully. But it's not just in this issue. We'll see it a lot, where you'll even have various bad guys talk about, well, this is how I would defeat the Fantastic Four. This is what I would do when I am ruler of the sovereign nation of
King of the Forest.
Yes. That's one of the things that, I don't know, you probably don't notice if you space out your reading of these issues in this series, but reading them kind of back to back as I did, there was like, okay, here we go. Let me take a drink. So I don't know. I don't know if anyone picked up on that, but it's something that you certainly don't see today that can be a little bit jarring, but is also charming.
I noticed that Hulk can control his transformations at will here.
Yeah, it's like a radioactive scale or something that he steps upon, it looks like.
Simulates the experience that turned him into the Hulk in the first place. I think they're still finding their way with the character.
Very much so, and thankfully we didn't have to read any individual issues of Incredible Hulk this time.
And one thing that's actually interesting, Russell, you said it, we didn't have to read any individual issues of Incredible Hulk for this year's reading list. Part of the reason is because the same month that Fantastic Four 12 was released, they canceled Incredible Hulk. It was his final issue. Incredible Hulk number 6 for the time being was released. So after Fantastic Four 12, there is no more Incredible Hulk solo series.
Yeah, can't imagine why. For more on that, see Marvel Masterclass. But in any case, Todd's right. They're still finding their way with this character, trying to figure out just exactly what to do with him. But I'm glad we did away with the whole he changes at night, werewolf, Mr. Hyde deal.
Yeah, you know, I am as well, but I don't want to criticize Dave too much because he's been very gracious to put these out there for people who want to get a good Cliff's Notes, but I almost wonder why the transition from gray to green and the transition from going away from that nighttime transformation to a self-controlled transformation wasn't covered on the reading list. That seems pretty significant and something that probably should have been in there, at least in terms of understanding the chronology of the Hulk character as he developed.
Maybe. I'm going to go back and read. I'm going to torture myself and read some of this Incredible Hulk to see if they – I'm sure they'll explain the transformation thing, but I'm actually thinking that the gray to green thing is probably just something they ignore. They just decide to start coloring him green because it was more interesting. Because as we pointed out with the Iron Man debut in this year, it was kind of that the 60s Silver Age equivalent of a grim and gritty kind of story. Incredible Hulk number 1 was that for the previous year. And I feel like with that character, by including him here in Fantastic Four, I think they were trying to move that character away from that feel and make him a little bit more, I guess, for lack of a better term, fantastic. Or fantastical. Yes, they wanted him to be that. They wanted him to feel like something that the kids would really get into, less monster movie, less horror kind of book, and more superhero. And what better way to do that than to put him in the pages of the Fantastic Four?
And I want to say it looks like this issue was on the stands at the same time as ASM number 1. So it's actually two crossovers in the same month. We get, although this being kind of the Hulk swan song with his solo series, still he's guest starring in Fantastic Four, the Fantastic Four guest starring in Spider-Man. So they lean pretty heavily into that quite quickly.
Yeah, they go heavy on the crossover points right from the jump. So this is a common theme for Marvel throughout its history. And here I find it really interesting just because for that first year, the 61 to 62 we read, everything felt very self-contained, like these characters aren't going to be aware of each other at all. And then just all of a sudden, in less than maybe 6 months later, they are all keenly aware of each other. Although there is a theme that runs through several issues that they don't necessarily believe that the stories they hear about these other characters are real. They think that maybe it's made up stuff. So that's a theme that I think we're going to touch on in just a few minutes.
Yeah. Well, great point, Russell. Yeah.
And you'll recall that an issue, I guess, 2 of Fantastic Four, they scare off the Skrulls by recounting stories from Incredible Hulk comic books. So
yes,
it's been established, but it's already been established that there are Marvel comics within the Marvel universe. You know, we go back to the previous issue of FF that we looked at in number 10 here. And it's like, I don't know, they're playing a little bit fast and loose with that, but by establishing that, oh yeah, these are characters, they all inhabit the same world, and there are comics published about them. They aren't the same comics that you're reading now, but they're kind of similar, so
yeah,
very good.
Breaking the fourth wall and going meta, that was a Marvel thing from the jump.
Yes.
I'm going to point out one random panel. This is in reaction to the Thing tearing up something, saying, I would do this to the Hulk. And General Thunderbolt Ross says, oh no, the Big Ape ruined my bound set of telephone books. Of all the- I did chortle quite a bit at that.
And then, yes. I am so glad you brought that up. Because
Reed Richards says they'll reimburse him.
Your collection of phone books, what in the, even for the 60s, bound. What in the actual fuck? Your bound collection of phone books.
And you guys want to talk about something, things that are fully formed from the jump? That Thunderbolt Ross mustache is on point from the very first appearance all the way up until now. Just outstanding mustache work that made you understand why Sam Elliott was cast eventually in the Ang Lee Hulk movie. One other thing, a theme I think we need to track here as we go along, and I think I know the answer to this, but I'll throw the question out at various points throughout this podcast as we go forward. Is there ever a point at which Rick Jones does not suck? Thus far, the answer is no.
Also, still throwing this out there, my theory about Rick Jones from Incredible Hulk number one still stands.
Ah, yes.
Often with hands upon one another.
He loves Bruce Banner.
Well, does that mean that later on in future episodes, we're going to discuss how much he loves Steve Rogers?
You know what? I think that he probably does, because, I mean, there was nothing wrong with it, but I guess whenever it comes to the 1960s and you're trying to put a gay character in your comic, you had to be a little ambiguous with it because people were probably not quite ready to accept that yet. But Rick Jones, maybe the first major mainstream gay character in comics.
And of course,
actually, I want to, you know, you're joking a little bit. I think I actually want to talk about perhaps the debut of a mainstream gay character a little bit later on. And I think Tim knows where I'm going with this. But let's move on to actually, Todd, you had something real quick.
Just when Bruce reappears after changing back from being the Hulk, He resembles my roommate Jakob with his baseball cap and glasses. that's a callback to Talking Pop.
How about a little inside baseball, folks?
Are you suggesting that Betty Ross is very loud?
No.
No comment there. That's maybe Sue Storm is rather loud.
Yes.
There we go.
As our crossover event.
She would have to be. You can't see her.
You know, we did such a good job of avoiding the inside baseball the first time around, and it was only a matter of time before we delved into it here, I think.
It's inevitable with Place to Be Nation. Pop.
I'm going to plug Talking Pop episode 2.
Has Talking Pop won any prestigious awards here in recent times?
I see where you're going.
The Welpy Award winning.
Welpy.
Never mind.
The Place to Be Nation Happy Award winning Talking Pop, I should say, episode 2.
It only took him 3 tries.
Yeah. We got there eventually. But let's move on to the next issue of Fantastic Four. Go ahead, Tim.
Jesus.
No, the next episode of Fantastic Four is
well done.
Number.
Good job, sir.
Is number 12, or is it 12?
13,
excuse me. That's where we get the introduction to the Red Ghost and his super apes. We also get the Watcher.
I was about to say, if not for the Watcher, should this have even been on the reading list?
Well, they got to the moon. Man has landed on the moon here, guys.
And we get the blue area of the moon. Too.
I have a question about a serious question about this issue. Okay. Is this cover on Marvel Unlimited the original cover for this issue?
I don't know. Why? Why do you ask?
It feels a little bit more modern with the coloring and the inking.
That's a great point. Yeah, I'm looking at it now, and you bring up a good point.
Also, if this is actually the original cover from 63, holy shit, this is awesome. This is my favorite looking cover of this year. Like, I absolutely love this.
It could be a Darwin Cook piece of art.
It looks like a Darwin Cook piece. But I actually wound up really liking this issue. It's not quite as good as the one that we're going to talk about right after it, but I kind of dug Red Ghost, and I actually really liked what this issue was trying to do and getting kids excited about space, about like exploration, mm-hmm. and the idea of pushing themselves to discover new things, like not trying to beat bad guys. That's not the point, although this issue actually feels very Secret Wars-ish. But I just dug the hell out of the idea of trying to inspire a younger generation to want to leave our planet and explore the stars. I thought this was really great on the part of Lee and Kirby.
Yeah, I don't think it hit for me quite as much as it did you, because while I found the moon base setting interesting, I don't know, something about the Red Ghost and his super apes just didn't strike me as an overly interesting villain, especially considering we had gotten to this point Dr. Doom and the Skrulls and Namor and just a run of great villains for the FF on this reading list. And this was the first one that I kind of went, I don't know, man. But to answer your question earlier,
with you on the villain, I just like the plot.
Yeah. To answer your question earlier, though, apparently, yes, this is the original cover, but it has been recolored for Marvel Unlimited. So.
Okay. At least that makes some semblance of sense, though. But still, badass cover. Like it. Like it a lot.
Tim, I think you were going to jump in there.
Yeah, I have always hated the Red Ghost as a villain, as a character, and that is coming
from someone. He's recurring?
Oh, yeah, this guy comes up a lot.
Oh, God, no.
with the apes. That?
Here we go.
You didn't know this? Oh, my friend.
No, I didn't know this. I'm not that versed in Fantastic Four lore, so now that I know he's coming back and it gets worse, well.
Oh, yeah, the apes all have names. They aren't named. I know. And that's the other thing. I hate that fucking trope in comic of the superpowered apes thing. Like, remember the from the either late 90s or early 2000s, the JL Ape event?
Yeah,
which
vaguely.
Was just what a dark period in my life and in comics, where it's just all ape all the time. It's just no.
Tim
stop.
Hates monkeys.
I do. I do.
Oh, God, Thursday. You're not. I'm going to have to talk to Tim about his opinions on certain other characters soon, then. But knowing that the super apes are recurring actually lowers my opinion of this issue a bit. So
well, that's the thing. I ended up really enjoying this in spite of my my hatred in my speciesist, I guess, views. I will point out that somewhat pedantically here, baboons are monkeys, not apes. I think perhaps he was going for chimpanzee, but landed on baboon for one of these supposed apes. But no matter, we get the Red Menace being laid on pretty thick here, as was mentioned before, but then it goes in a rather almost Star Trek, like original Star Trek direction, where they're then going into this sort of metaphor of, okay, and this is not the greatest comparison to draw, admittedly, but I guess the super apes are supposed to represent the communist civilians living under the thumb of horrible, evil leaders like the Red Ghost, and you give them a taste of freedom, man, and they're gonna overthrow their communist overlords. So there's a little bit of that going on.
It's a little on the nose.
Yeah, and Reed is kind of just kumbaya about the whole affair, where it's just, can't we all get along? We both made it to the moon here. And by the way, this is the blue area of the moon, which has an atmosphere that is breathable.
And you guys have mentioned the moon. I think I need to stop here, even though I was critical of this issue and kind of, you know, not really intrigued by it as much as you guys were. I think Kirby turns an outstanding work here. All this moon-based stuff feels like it's right up his alley, leaning more into the sci-fi aspects than the traditional superheroics. So while the plot of this one wasn't necessarily for me, Jack Kirby brought it here.
My favorite panel isn't even on the moon. It's the part where Thing and Reed Richards have had a bit of a disagreement, and Thing folds him up and slides him into a clear cylinder.
What from the entirety of his body in that little container.
Tremendous artwork on that particular panel. As hilarious as it is, when you break it down, like get in close on it, look at it. That is some good work on Thing. I fully agreed with Kirby really bringing his A game on this. Also really like the photo negative of Red Ghost at one point.
It's a great panel.
I thought that was pretty. And then the very next one of the circular part is right at the beginning of part two, Menace on the Moon. That panel of all of the four together like that, man, that's just damn good work.
It really is. So I think Russell and Tim and myself have talked about this one a great deal. Todd, do you have any thoughts here on Fantastic Four 12 or 13? Excuse me.
I think this is notable for the introduction of the Watcher, and you're going to get, you know, the Watcher who's only supposed to observe, but here he does not just observe. He says, "Nope, give me your champions, and we'll have them fight it out." And
which is a great call. I mean, I think Russell or Tim, perhaps it was that already referenced a very Secret Wars feel about it. So that even draws. Yeah, that greater parallel, like you just said, the Watcher playing that active role in the story, not unlike who was it in Secret Wars, the Collector?
No, that's the
which Secret Wars are we talking?
The original
about?
Secret God. Wars?
Yeah, the original.
Beyonder.
Yeah, the Beyonder.
Beyonder. Right. So yeah, I do love the abandoned city aspect of this. It's beautiful. And I think we're going to end up talking about it someday in the pages of Conversation, or the pages, the listening annals of Conversation Comics. The blue area of the moon will eventually be reused in a Marvel story here. Pretty good full-length story, but the Red Ghost is himself a mort. And you did have the themes of pseudoscience. I mean, it's a big deal for us to get to the moon, but Fantastic Four will get there in three pages. Only to find that the Red Ghost and his band of super apes and super monkey are already there. So, but we can't tell anybody because that would, I'm just putting myself in that the space race is such a big deal on the minds of the readers at this point. But the art is spectacular for the time, especially the cityscape. So,
Todd. Did you pick up on the scene that will be later homaged by John Byrne?
Let's see. Is it Reed kind of shooting the paralysis ray?
It is not. Okay. It's maybe something that you wouldn't necessarily think of because you say you wonder, okay, John Byrne, Fantastic Four writer artist, got to be something in that run, but you mentioned Conversation Comics, and there's a sequence here where the Watcher sends the Red Ghost like tumbling through time and space when he, you know, invades his sanctum. And
oh yeah, there goes Wolverine, right?
Is that yep. Okay. From most famous X-Men story of all time ever, and I never knew that until reading this issue, and immediately I went, oh my God, that's why that was in X-Men 137.
Yep, there it is. It kind of
blew my mind.
The Watcher is an interesting character. You ought to look out for him in future issues.
Ah, very well done. On that note, though, I thought it was interesting because a lot of the modern incarnations of the Watcher have him as this not just neutral observer, but he's borderline nonverbal at a lot of times. And here he was talking a lot and playing a much more active role in the story than I was accustomed to. So a very, very interesting debut for the Watcher. But I think this little trio of Fantastic Four issues that we read, I don't know about you guys, but for me, there was an unquestioned standout of these three, and it was Fantastic Four Annual Number One. Unprecedented at this point in Marvel's publishing history, because for the first time, not just 23 pages, but 72 pages of story, most of those devoted to one extremely long form story that, you know, Tim mentioned earlier. You know, a lot of these Silver Age stories take a while to read, and this one especially. I think I spent a good 45 minutes to an hour with this one, and I gotta say, guys, I walked away from it not just thinking it was good for this era, but I thought it holds up very well from a modern context.
Yeah, I would concur with you. This is in a really good showcase for the creators, too, where they've got room to stretch out. Kirby is taking full advantage of the format. He's even putting in some splash pages within, you know, the interiors of the story, which didn't see a whole lot of back then. The coloring seems to be much cleaner as well. Then we got in sort of just the monthly issues. So that was something I picked up on. The banter between the characters is well established now, and they're quippy. They feel more like themselves as we know them. And so I just thought this was a case of good story, good timing, really good format that served it well. Yeah, I spent a good probably hour plus with it myself, and it was like a hearty meal.
It almost reads
ribs meal.
It almost reads like the closest thing the Silver Age would have had to a trade paperback. Like, it feels like an original graphic novel in many respects, just because of how dense it is and how much story they cover. And it's really cool because it feels like, you know, we've had a couple of different Namor stories that we read on the reading list. We've had several different Doctor Doom stories where there are recurring appearances, but this really feels like the culmination of something with Namor that it's built to. Like, it doesn't have that feel of just another one-off disposable Namor story. This feels like the realization of everything that Namor had been portrayed to be up until this point. Todd, you know, Tim and I have talked about it a little bit. Were you as into this one as we were?
Yeah, this is a true epic in every sense of the word, especially for the time. You get Namor returning to form after his short-lived stint as a Hollywood producer, evil Hollywood producer. He is back under the sea and here to kind of usurp the surface world. And I do love that you get a lot of the Atlantean families and characters, and Namor's long origin story with his parents falling in love, and all kinds of things, plus just fantastic art, especially the undersea sequences by Kirby. So I'm just an amazing story.
What about the political aspects of this one? Like, where you've got, you know, cameos from
Khrushchev,
and I believe John F. Kennedy pops up in this one, and then you've got the United Nations, and like, it really is. I mean, the Marvel Universe has always been said to live more in the real world than DC does, and I think here early on we've seen glimpses of that, but this is the first one where it really jumps out at you and kind of hits you in the face with, hey man, this is living in the very real world of 1963 at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And you had the Cuban tensions going on at the same point. Just, it's hard to take the comic out of the era that it's in. And luckily, they put a lot of the era into the comic. I also like all the things in the back of the issue, from the chronological listing of all the villains that they put in.
Yes.
It's kind of recaps with where you get pinups of everything. You also got,
is this the one with the diagram of the diagram of the Baxter building?
Yeah. And that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's Jack Kirby at his finest. That's 100% Jack Kirby. with cross sections and the just imaginary places in there that we've never seen that he thought of and put them in. You also have the questions and answers about the Fantastic Four. Why is Mr. Fantastic's hair white at the temples? Is he older than he looks? Well, and we thought, well, of course, is he must be a little bit older, right? He's a doctor. He's a professor. But no, it turns out it turned white during World War II, which was, again, almost 20 years ago at this point from 1963, when he aided Allied prisoners to escape from the Nazis. So a story we never have heard, but well, what about that turned his hair white? I don't know, but that was that one kind of got me. And then they talk about the unstable molecules of the uniforms. Just all this extra content in the issue. You imagine being a 10-year-old kid getting this for the summer. You know, these annuals would come out during the summer. This would be the thing you read all summer long.
You know, and that's a great point, Todd. And I think I said this in our little offline group chat we have. I miss the era in comics when annuals actually mattered, because it's rare these days to go to your shop and pick up an annual and it actually feel important. Usually it's just this longer form kind of one-off story, or perhaps it's an anthology book, you know, just featuring a scattershot of shorter form stories. But there used to be a time when annuals were big freaking deals. And of course, in a future episode of Marvel Age, we're going to talk about a Fantastic Four annual that could very well be one of, if not the most influential issues in all of Fantastic Four, that being the wedding of Reed and Sue. And, you know, this one just drove home to me the role that annuals played back then and could probably still play today if comic publishers took the time to put effort into them.
It is a textbook example of what you want from an annual, and Todd really described that beautifully. I was thinking exactly the same thing, just being a kid, a 10-year-old, and picking this up off the stands in the summer when I've got loads of free time, and this is going to be something I revisit over and over and over again. It's one of those gifts that keeps on giving. I especially love that Baxter Building schematic. That was the type of thing you love to see in an annual. Because there's so many opportunities to do that kind of thing. You might get like the X-Mansion, or, you know, the Danger Room, the Blackbird, if it's an X-Men annual. The Avengers would have their Quinjet, just all this stuff that they would cram those types of technical details into your annuals to fill out pages. But such a great way to do so, because it's just one of those things to obsess on when you're a kid, right? And you of course, get the oversized feature story that is, as you said, Nick, something that is actually important and good at the same time.
Yes.
These are two very important distinctions of annuals of this time period. And the thing about the Submariner is, while he is a recurring antagonist for the Fantastic Four, he's one whose story has been kind of leading to something. Like, he's had a motivation where he's working towards something in all of his appearances. He's trying to find like the remnants of his undersea kingdom, since when we were first introduced to him, he was amnesiac, and he's gradually getting his memories back and knowing who the fuck he is, right? And now he has found his undersea kingdom, which is almost having been taken over by this warlord General Krang, who I do believe we're going to see some more of, and Lady
really
Dorma. So we get the what? I'm going to leave that alone.
Well done, sir. Well done.
I could go in a lot of places that would perhaps be too inside baseball.
Oh, so, man. Listen to us going against our base instincts and not playing inside baseball at times.
It's taking so much. It really is. You know, the romantic tension now with Namor's lady love, this character Dorma, and kind of drawing a line under that whole thing with he and Susan Storm, at least for the time being. Of course, it's going to come up again over and over, but there is some sense of resolution here to that. Gotcha. So, yeah, there's a lot going on with this story and this annual in particular.
Plus, you got a retelling of Spider-Man trying to join the Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. Slightly redrawn by Kirby here. You still see the Ditko layouts, but it very obviously Kirby did a little bit more of the detail work here.
Yes, an extended scene.
A great point. A great point there, Todd. Not really a reprint, but not really original material either. So something of an interesting approach for the backup feature here. So I think we're all unanimous in praise for the annual. And before we take a break, let's touch on one more issue that perhaps we're going to also be in unanimous agreement on, but I think it's going to fall on the other side. And we'll see how you guys feel about it. But that being the debut issue of a little book called Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos. This, of course, coming from Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And guys, I got to say, this was one of the ones on this reading list that didn't do much for me, honestly. What did you guys think of this one?
I kind of liked it in a guilty pleasure way. Fury, there's very little likable about him, but the actual really war is. Story, I enjoyed that aspect of it. And trying to maybe a little bit more of an emphasis on strategical maneuvers, as our former president would have said, and the actual weaponry of the time. I did like some of it, and I do like Dum Dum Dugan and your introduction to the rest of the crew, but they all were kind of interchangeable apart from the Lothario character at that point. I want to see
and Gabriel Jones, who is drawn in the
not interchangeable.
Yeah. Gabriel Jones, who is drawn in the same hue as Grey Hulk from Incredible Hulk number one, which is very interesting.
Yeah, they were probably still figuring out how to do that.
As I understand it, that was a printing error that Stan Lee later would specifically try to correct and say, hey, this is meant to be black, by the way. So that doesn't really come across in this first issue, but he is very much a black man, as we will see from issue two on.
And is he the first notable example of an African American character in the Marvel Universe to this point?
Yes. I thought so. Even a supporting character at this point.
Although, granted, he is, you know, being portrayed back during the World War II time, so not necessarily in the modern context, but he exists now in the continuity, you know, whereas we haven't seen anybody like that, you know, to this point.
He's white on the cover, too.
Yeah, he very much is. Now, this is a war comic, and I wish I was, I don't know, just educated enough to talk about and draw comparisons to other war comics, and I'm just not really. So I'm afraid I may be doing it a disservice because I don't know how this looks in comparison.
I can't speak about that either, Tim. I can just speak from my own perspective. I was kind of bored by this. Like, I thought the first few pages where Nick Fury was just being a dick and like leading the guys through these really like sadistic forms of training was moderately entertaining, but the rest of it, when they were actually on the mission, I found myself just wanting to get through it and on to the next capes and tights thing, you know, to track more of the development of the Marvel Universe. Because this, with the exception of giving us Nick Fury, it's hard to really sit here and say this provides any sort of real building block for what we know today.
And I suppose it is notable. It did feel long, yeah.
It did, yeah. It really did. You know, so many of these, I mean, Tim and I have touched on it a few times, a lot of these feel long, and a lot of these feel more dense than your average modern comic, but this one especially, it just felt long because it didn't have that oomph to it. It didn't have that pacing to it that I think we've come to expect from even, you know, stuff like Fantastic Four or Amazing Spider-Man. So, I don't know. I kind of wound up giving this one a big old shrug of the shoulders, verging on probably a thumbs down for me.
Yeah, I do think there's value in it in just illustrating the other types of comics that were out there. We looked at the strict anthology format, somewhat Twilight Zone-esque feel of, you know, Amazing Adult Fantasy in our debut episode. And this here, again, you have a war comic. And it's a little bit impressive how Lee and Kirby can do this somewhat effortless genre shifting. Like, they've been doing so much superhero stuff, and now we have something totally in a different direction. And from what Ben Morris was saying on Marvel Age Masterclass, maybe was more in his wheelhouse, more the type of comic he wanted to be doing versus the capes and spandex. So maybe it's throwing him a bone a little bit. I don't know.
That's a good point. But this also went on longer than stuff like Incredible Hulk, for example.
Oh, so yeah.
It must have been at least either, one, a moderate financial success, or two, something that Stan and Jack were really dedicated to. I don't know which of those is the case. I don't have the numbers in front of me, obviously. But, you know, it clearly is something that was at least interesting to the creators.
They don't actually stay on it that long. But the series does continue for many, many years.
Because Kirby is gone by, what is it, issue 9 or so, I think?
Yeah, 7 or 9, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, Kirby leaves with issue 7, and then Stan Lee leaves at issue 28. But still, that's Stan for 28 issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more than a lot of comics got at that point. So yeah, that's Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. And that brings us to the halfway point of our reading list, and thus, time for a little break. So thanks for listening thus far. Stick with us through the break, and when we come back, we're going to hit on a couple of more notable points in Marvel history, that being the debut of the Wasp and also the very first issues of both Avengers and Uncanny or adjectiveless X-Men, depending on your preference. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceforNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
He said in winter 1963, it felt like the world would freeze with John F. Kennedy and the Beatles.
Welcome back, true believers, to the second half of the second episode of the Marvel Age podcast, covering 1963 in Marvel's publishing history. I want to take this opportunity to say that this episode of Marvel Age is brought to you by trademark shitty Southern Internet. That's right, trademark shitty Southern Internet, which affected one of the Sarcastic Four, Mr. Russell Sellers, who you may have noticed had to drop off near the end of our first half. So he actually missed a little discussion, so I'm going to give him a chance to catch up real quick. In particular, he missed the discussion on Fantastic Four Annual Number 1 and Sergeant Fury on his Howling Commando. So, Russell, before we jump into another shitty comic with Tales to Astonish 44, do you have any thoughts on the two issues that you missed?
Well, first, it wasn't just the internet. I had to run out as the human torch of this group and go inspire a young teenager who was feeling a bit blue about not being able to pay his aunt's rent. And that took up a little bit of my time, but I'm back.
In the meantime, did you take a random floozy?
Is Andrew going to be okay?
I think so. I think he's sufficiently inspired, and he even found a way to pay his rent for the next year. So, hey, you know, props to that guy.
And in the meantime, did you take David Sunday to your favorite parking spot?
A couple of them, but I'm not sure how inspired he is. We'll just have to wait and see how he feels a little bit later. But maybe he'll feel about this Fantastic Four Annual Number 1 the same way that I did, which was to say, quite enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And that's really saying something, considering I am kind of proven not to be the biggest Fantastic Four fan in the world, but I got to give props to this annual. I'm sure you guys covered it in depth, so I'll just say real stakes. Namor is the best Fantastic Four villain, and at the end of this, it all felt, you know, like some pretty heavy stuff for this very traditionally lighthearted superhero fare. So Lee Kirby kind of killed it on that one. Very Throne of Atlantis, if you will, in some ways. And then moving on to Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. I'll keep this one brief. It sucked. It was one of the just biggest snooze fests I think I've ever seen. And that shouldn't happen for a war comic, especially one that's drawn actually pretty well here by Jack Kirby. But Nick Fury is so much better as a super spy or as head of S.H.I.E.L.D., but leading this group of platoon, whatever, of soldiers through Nazi-occupied Germany to, or France, I guess it is, to save a random group of French soldiers who were working undercover or some other bullshit. I don't know. I don't care. I lost interest within the first, like, three pages of this and just kind of skimmed the rest of the way through it. There's Nick Fury. There's Dum Dum Dugan. There, I've told you everything important about this issue, and we can move on now.
Don't forget Gabriel Jones, because he was colored gray, much like the original Hulk.
Yes, and I, much like that first issue of Incredible Hulk, failed to give a single shit.
And what a great segue there, Russell, because much like you failed to give a single shit about Sergeant Furious Howling Commandos number 1, I failed to give a single shit about Tales to Astonish 44. This issue is notable mainly for the introduction of Janet Van Dyne, a.k.a. the Wasp, into the Ant-Man pantheon, into the Ant-Man mythology, giving him his first full-fledged sidekick and a partner that would extend across his publishing history up until this very day, and who would become, as we'll discuss later, a founding member of the Avengers. So this one here, much like our previous Tales to Astonish issue that we discussed on last month's episode, you know, there are things happening here that are moderately interesting, but the problem is there's so much dead space in between them that the issue as a whole becomes just god-awfully boring and leaves me with one burning question. Just how young is Janet Van Dyne supposed to be? Are we talking a Hal Jordan Aresia-like situation here? Like, how uncomfortable is this supposed to make us?
That I was – oh, God. Well, I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb here and say that I liked this issue more than I liked the previous Tales to Astonish. But
well, sure, but
– that bar – let me finish, Tim. That bar – is on the floor.
Right.
So being better than that is not a tall order. That said, yes, this was – it started off kind of sad, but still didn't make me really care all that much about Hank Pym. And then he's going – clearly he's trying to resist diddling this young girl, and it never gets any better. It just keeps getting more and more uncomfortable as this goes. And while credit Jack Kirby for some good art, holy shit, is Ant-Man ever going to be interesting? Is he ever going to be, more interesting than, you know, your run-of-the-mill pedophile?
You know,
I'm going to say no.
You know, I got it. Finally, I've seen it now. I'm looking at his hair in one of these panels. Hank Pym is the Jerry Lee Lewis, and Janet Van Dyne is his 13-year-old cousin. That's what it is, pretty much.
Yep. And how about their... Oh God, that terrible opening story. I'm sorry, but it just wasn't good. The whole flashback sequence and his motivation for becoming a superhero. It's, I mean,
yes, we've spent a lot of time on this elaborate flashback / daydream that he's having about his first wife, Melania. I mean, Maria, and her terrible
fate.
Very
good.
And and that's the other problem. It's not just the age of
damn it, Tim.
Janet.
Now I am going to read Hank Pym in a certain voice now and forever for the rest of my life. Thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. And it's a shame because before reading these early appearances of Hank Pym, I mean, yes, he's a pretty boring character, but he's also pretty much the definition of a Marvel B-list supporting character in that. There has been some interesting stuff done with him, even though he's not the most engaging character in his own right. I'm thinking about some of the work that, like, you know, Jim Shooter had done, even the little comeback that he had in the late 80s and early 90s
Here's something that we should probably track throughout the course of this entire podcast is how many times I say a variation of the following thought. And here we go. And Todd, prepare to roll your eyes in advance. Ultimate Universe did it better. Because as problematic as he is, at least he's interesting. Like, he is a man that is entirely driven by his own, like, ego, and his inability to process his ego being damaged leads to virtually everything interesting about that character in the Ultimate Universe, as opposed to here, where there is nothing interesting about this character. So I'm going to stand by it. Ultimate Universe did it better.
The most interesting thing in the Ultimate Universe about Hank Pym is when Captain America beats the ever-living fuck out of him, which
that
was one of
yes, and it's an yes. It's an earned moment. It's absolutely an earned moment, and you care.
And there's one moment here in this issue where they really get my hopes up, only to dash them, as Hank Pym loads himself into a cannon, but instead of firing himself directly into the sun, he only makes it across town. So I guess, you know, baby steps.
Well, and we have not just the issue of
they give the these very... they give these people 20 pages of a 26-page anthology book, and it feels like 40. This feels longer to me than that Fantastic Four annual.
That was my takeaway as well, and that was why I disliked this more than his Ant-Man's first appearance, which I don't think was this long, or at least it didn't feel like it was.
I don't think it was either.
No, it was more of an anthology, length story.
Yeah, and
this was a two-story issue, but the second one was much shorter.
Much shorter. We have not just the unfortunate question of the Ditko story exactly. The question of Janet's age looms large over this, but also so he's trading on the memory of his murdered wife to get a newer model. He keeps talking about how she reminds him so much of Maria, just over and over and over. And I'm like, number one, why? And number two, how is that relevant? Just what is this? What are we trying to do here? And so it's just got those very strange character touches. And then the plot is, we're going back to generic monsters, I see. That's always something.
They're going back to the well because, honestly, can you name, other than Yellowjacket, name an Ant-Man villain?
Ghost, because she's in Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Okay, yeah. we get one for the movie, but then beyond that, nothing.
Yeah. Oral cancer.
since we're reading him as a certain character now, does that mean that we can start calling Janet Ivanka? Just to make this seem
God.
Incredible.
Oh no.
Gross.
So is he gonna become huge man instead of giant man going forward?
Yep. That's how I'm gonna read him from now on because as awful as it'll be, it might actually make getting through this story that much more interesting because I can't wait to see what horrible thing he says next.
Ugh. Bigly man.
I have to assume sales were pretty good on this, which is weird, but I guess it was just about the
how?
It's got a science fiction or sci-fi fascination at the time.
That, and it has to be on the strength of the artwork because the writing is shit.
Yeah, it's...
Well, who the hell is H.E. Huntley? Who scripted this? Did you notice that?
Yeah, I did. And somebody who probably didn't get a whole fuck ton of work after this.
Maybe it was Stan and he was just too embarrassed to put his name on it.
No, I wondered that. And it says, so this is a pseudonym. Ernie Hart, Ernest Huntley Hart is the writer. He had done some funny animal comics before this. So I guess that's what he cut his teeth on. And
well, God, he should have made this funny, and at least it would have been interesting. Shit, man.
Yeah, right. Because apparently serious sci-fi ain't his bag, baby.
No. Nor should it be.
It doesn't look like he did much else here.
If it was Kirby pencils, the Heck inks really were Don Heck faces. That was definitely clear.
I've noticed that I really love it when Don Heck is inking Jack Kirby.
Yeah, that is a good combo. Something I did get some entertainment out of. So, number one, the generic alien we referenced kills the Wasp's dad. So, some rando alien killed Wasp's father. Somewhat trivial, but a little bit humorous to me. But the way that the alien is summoned, through this super-powered telescope apparatus deal that Professor Van Dyne is using. Wasn't this the climax to Howard the Duck, the movie?
Yeah, I think it was.
Which I've never actually seen, by the way.
And I figure a lot of people who
are Travelers for Hire.
Yeah.
Y'all got to do it.
Damn it, Todd. Yep, it's on the schedule now.
Yep.
We obligate ourselves to do anything that any listener asks for, even if those listeners are just doing so to be dicks. But that's neither here nor there.
But no, that is certainly a thing. Again, keeping with the unfortunate characterization and comparisons we can draw to another contemporary figure today of Hank Pym, I wrote down... Real heroes dismiss traumatized young women by calling them spoiled, bored society brats, which is what he does when Janet calls him in distress to see that her father had been killed.
All right, so honestly, let's give our best guess. Based on the context clues we're given here and the way she's drawn, What are you guys thinking? How old is she supposed to be here? I'm going to go 17. I'm going to go 15.
17 sounds good.
I'm going to go 15. Russell?
I'm going to split the difference and say 16.
And say 16. And he's supposed to be what? Are we thinking like 30?
At least. 20, between, yeah. Late 20s to mid 30s. So
younger than Reed Richards, but not a lot.
Yeah.
Just enough to make it really uncomfortable.
Yeah. I don't know, man. You know, it was a different time where age range wasn't nearly as big as a deal as it is now, I guess, but still, I don't know.
Men died at 50 anyway.
Oh, God. All right, so...
Uncomfortable.
All right.
Yeah.
So, anything else we need to touch on about Ant-Man and the Wasp before we move on to dive back into some Fantastic Four? You guys got anything else?
Yes, please. One more thing.
Yes, please.
You first, Russell. Did you have something, Russell?
Really hoping for no more Tales to Astonish in 64.
Okay.
Really, well, really hoping for that.
What I had was, this is an example of the character's superpowers being exponentially less useful to the resolution of the story. Because he comes up with, like, an antidote to...
Oh, God, to folic acid or something like that.
Yeah, whatever the compound is that this alien is made out of. So he's going to shoot it with shotgun pellets that are filled with this compound, this substance that he has put together. But in order to do that, he shrinks down the... Shotgun remains full size, and his ants literally march it into the city, and he pulls the trigger while he is still ant size. It seems like, you know, you kind of cut through the shit and just done this, you know, as a dude. Like, you don't need shrinking power to enact this plan. In fact, it makes it much, much more difficult.
He pulls the trigger twice while an ant trying. One last note to any current or future Ant-Man film writer, do not use the comics as your basis for your stories. You're better off just figuring this shit out on your own.
Are you saying you don't want to see the creature from Cosmos as a villain in a future Ant-Man film?
I'm saying I don't think I want to see anything remotely resembling Tales to Astonish to wind up in an Ant-Man movie, because this is already a movie series that's fighting an uphill battle with me.
God, and you guys have already called her Ivanka, and now I just thought of the movie where... Oh, never mind.
Yep.
Well, this
you
is,
can't unsee it.
Oh, Jesus.
This is the MST3K of comics that we've read so far, this issue.
It is... It's awful, man. Like, I don't know what they were thinking with this early Ant-Man, but... You know, we're spending so much time talking about it, so let's move on to something that is a little bit better. Yes. However, I'm going to use this issue as to lay out one of my prevailing theories here over the first 2 years of Marvel publishing history, and that theory is Ant-Man ruins everything, because next up on the list we have Fantastic Four 16 and 17, the first part of which, Fantastic Four 16, is an Ant-Man crossover. And while this issue is not bad per se, I found it far inferior to the subsequent issue, Fantastic Four 17, leading me to believe that, yes, Ant-Man ruins everything. Guys, what were your thoughts here on Fantastic Four 16, where we see the Fantastic Four take a trip into the microverse?
And this also, I guess, to play off of that theory that Ant-Man ruins everything, he's completely useless. In this story.
Yeah, they call him for an expert opinion on why they're randomly shrinking down at various points, and he pretty much tells them, I don't know.
He's like,
sure, but try this. See you later.
He's like, here's this stuff that I use, and later they do their thing, get trapped in the microverse. Ant-Man goes in to save them, gets captured himself, and has to be saved by the Fantastic Four. Can we just go ahead and acknowledge that not only is Ant-Man useless, it seems his creators are starting to feel the same way.
How can he be a surprise guest star if you put him on the cover?
Yeah.
Surprise, well, surprise ruin. Perhaps it's one of those things where, you know, they didn't see covers back then as early as we see them now. So when you walk into your local shop or whatever, to your drugstore or your grocery store or what have you, that's got the spinner rack, and you see that, you know, knowing the new Fantastic Four should be there any day now, you walk in and you see Ant-Man on the cover. That is a bit of a surprise to you. Maybe that's it.
Maybe that's it. One thing I think we need to acknowledge is that this issue is a sequel to Fantastic Four number 10, which was the first FF issue we covered this episode. And one of the things we did not talk about there was that at the conclusion of that issue, you know, the body swap between Reed Richards and Dr. Doom. Doom's master plan was to shrink the Fantastic Four down into non-existence, basically, which backfires on him, and so this is following up on what happened to them. But the reason I bring this up is because something we slept on, unfortunately, in FF number 10 was what can y'all tell me about dinosaur astronauts?
yes.
Go ahead, Todd, because I got nothing.
If I can recall correctly, it was in Doom's. Here's what I would do. Imagine.
Yep.
He imagined if the dinosaurs were to evolve, if they were the dominant species, what it would end up being. And so we got one panel, one glorious panel of dinosaurs with spacesuits and bubble helmets. So,
yes. and the glorious line that that dinosaurs grew themselves out of existence. So yes. Because their brains were so tiny, yet their bodies just continued growing. They, I guess, became stupider and stupider until they could no longer support themselves as a species. And
they're not showers, they're growers.
Right, but very much so. And Doom's master plan was, okay, so he's telling the Fantastic Four that he's going to shrink them, and while their bodies will be reduced, their powers will proportionately remain the same as they were when they were at full size. And then, for whatever reason, so they'll be much more powerful while they're tiny, Ant-Man-like. And then, when he re-enlarges them, for whatever reason, their powers will grow with them. So they're going to become more powerful. So basically, this is Dr. Doom trolling the Fantastic Four. And this story about dinosaurs, you know, continuing to evolve and becoming spacemen is just part of this ridiculous yarn that he's spinning. So it's great. It's really good stuff that I just felt like we had to acknowledge from that issue. But, you know, his plan backfires on him. He shrinks down. He's landed himself in the microverse, and now the Fantastic Four are getting pulled into that as well. So, yeah, what do you guys think of this as kind of an intro to this microverse concept?
I thought it was okay. Like, I mean, it again, I feel like pretty much all of these are better drawn than the Fantastic Four issues from 1961 or 1962. But I felt like of the Fantastic Four issues we read here, with perhaps the exception of the Red Ghost one, this is probably the least interesting one to me from a plot perspective. Like, it's fine, but not great, I guess.
I really love the concept of the microverse, and this was kind of a cool thing to explore that. But beyond the concept, Doom's plan, like most of his plans up to this point, becomes a little too ridiculous to just keep going with. And on top of that, a pure useless turn from Ant-Man. It kind of drags this one down. Even the artwork, like it, while it's good, it's not enough to bring this one back. I like Nick, I found this one to be far inferior to what would come directly after it. And it was another one of those issues. It was another issue of Fantastic Four where I found myself like getting about halfway in and thinking, all right, can we move this along? Why is this taking so fucking long to get to the end? Jesus Christ, I'm going to skim the rest.
All right.
Todd, did we? I feel like maybe you have different thoughts than us on this one.
Not necessarily. It is a fun little diversion of an issue. because of the microverse aspects. Okay, that was interesting. It makes you think about it quite a bit, but the best part of the issue is just yet another one of the hypotheticals. Well, what if this happened? What if this ended up happening? And where Sue Storm becomes a scullery maid and has to serve the lizard men of Talk.
yes.
That, just one panel of Sue holding a pot of I don't know what this kind of food is, and with her hair disheveled. More about that hair being messed up.
And it's also just a little strange because here we are in the microverse, which is conceivably the shrunken, just the microscopic universe of our Earth, and yet we have more throwaway alien invaders.
Right.
So
we're never seen again.
Yes, this is all just very strange. I felt like this is another one of those times where it's like, all right, well, you're running short of villains, so you need to just throw in random aliens. Oh, wait, we're in the shrunken universe, not so much, dealing with aliens from outer space. So would they just be like some random disease or some shit that's running around? I really don't know at this point. It all makes no sense, and I feel like we should just be done with this.
But the interesting,
I guess it's
– go ahead, Todd.
Notable just because it's a quote-unquote two-part Dr. Doom story.
That's what I was going to say. The notable thing here is that unlike previous appearances by Dr. Doom where they kind of write him off temporarily or send him off into space or shrink him down into the microverse and give you the impression that you're not going to see him again for a while, this one, as he's going back to the surface world, he directly references, hey, I'm not done with these guys, and I'm coming for them again very soon. And so the very next issue, 17, is technically the continuation of this one, and it feels like the first real two-part story that we've read thus far in this project. So let's jump right along to Fantastic Four 17, and I gotta say, guys, as underwhelmed as I was by 16, I wound up really enjoying 17.
I sort of did too, and 17 like flirts with being an epic almost, in that it is. While 16 is a self-contained, I guess you can call it, story, it's not exactly one and done, since we have the threat of Dr. Doom still looming. And as you said, it is that rare continuation directly between issues. It's not like they skipped a bunch of issues and came back to it, as we've seen previous to this. And, I mean, there are some goofy aspects to it. You've got Doom demanding a cabinet position.
Or what about Doom in disguise as the janitor with the corncob pipe?
Yes. Love it.
There was something to that whole idea of Doom wanting power. I think that they were trying to make him more interesting than a villain who just was after money.
Because for the first time they introduced that political aspect of his character, which, as we all know, would kind of become one of the defining characteristics in years to come.
Yeah, they were still – you can tell they're still really trying to find their way with Dr. Doom. He's not nearly as developed as some of the other characters in this universe.
But they're clearly super into him at this point because this is fifth or sixth appearance already in 17 issues. So one out of every three issues is a Dr. Doom issue at this point.
Yeah, definitely. They're trying to make him the true arch nemesis of the Fantastic Four. Despite at this point, I would say that Namor has more claim to that. But you can also tell that they're trying to move Namor away from being a villain, per se, and make him maybe more of an anti-hero in some respects. They're committed to the Doom character, and good on him, because later on he definitely would be what I would consider maybe the best Marvel villain. But here, once again, two steps forward, one step back with him. He's got a good base idea of get power means more than money, but his idea that, I just want a cabinet position. I just want a seat at the table. That's a little stupid. But there's still some cool imagery in this book. And do you notice we get a low-key cameo from JFK
Yeah.
Only from the chin down.
from the hair, like the forehead up. It's just a few short months before he would be assassinated.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And we have Doom also waging psychological warfare against the team.
Yeah, for the first time, really, as that we've seen one of these villains in the Fantastic Four, you know, take aim at them strictly to cause them psychological harm. I mean, yeah, you have the Namor and Sue Storm stuff, but they make a point of pointing out that Namor has genuine feelings for Sue Storm, and it isn't necessarily doing it just to cause Reed Richards' emotional distress. But here, with the whole Alicia Masters bit, you have got Doom being smart enough to go, hey, I know how to get to the thing who is the, you know, physical powerhouse of the team, and thus he is weakening the Fantastic Four by having Ben Grimm off of his game. So I actually kind of dug that. I know it, you know, especially looking at it today, it kind of tiptoes on the edge of fridging a little bit, where it's bad things happening to a woman strictly for the effect that it's going to have on her male counterpart. But that being said, I still found it interesting for Doom as a villain to go that route.
And in a shoot comment that aren't meant to be shoot comments, I think, I'm not sure whether it was this issue or 16. I think it was actually 16, but Ben actually refers to Alicia in the dialogue as Sue at one point after Reed like is testing out his latest and greatest cure for Ben's thing condition, reverts him to his human form. Alicia is helping him up, and he says, "Sue, baby." And I don't know. I don't think that was intentional.
Legal advice? Well,
could be that.
No, it was.
Reed did foist this on him, so. Yeah.
And but, I mean, that was a random
one of those mistakes that kind of works in a way.
And a random plot thread that would later be picked up and taken to its full fruition in the Ultimate Universe. So there's another Ultimate Universe reference for you here in this episode. Hey, heel Reed Richards is a great thing the Ultimate Universe gave us.
That is true.
So this was a good issue. But to me, it felt like it didn't have a lot of carryover from the previous issue. It was kind of like they did a quick patch job at the beginning where it ties in. So I guess that's the significance of it, is that it was the first time you had a two-part villain back-to-back, at least in a monthly. You had Doom in issue 5 and 6 as well when he had his team-up with Submariner. I do like this cover, but the average it was kind of an average issue to me. It's just all right, dog. I do like that you do see the Marvel Age of Comics prominently featured on the cover. So I like that.
Yes, the Marvel Age of Comics, which we are, of course, discussing.
And we will see that again in another issue here coming up in a second.
Yep. So you guys got any final thoughts on Fantastic Four 16 and 17 before we move forward?
Cool thing to see an actual kind of two-part story happening in this era. Last chapter, the back half, of course, being way better than the first. But good artwork all the way around. Kirby is still like really, really into doing this book. So glad to see that it's, you know, continuing that upward trend, and hope that continues on as we move forward into Fantastic Four history.
Absolutely. Well, moving forward, you know, I mentioned a little earlier that I did this, a similar project to this, a little while back, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, as kind of a, you know, just a personal solo project. I didn't do it for very long. It was something I intended to keep going and didn't wind up doing, and I'm looking forward to this, the existence of this podcast, forcing my hand to keep it going. But when I did do this personally, one of the hidden gems that I stumbled across that I wound up really loving in ways that I was never expecting were these little entries in the anthology book Strange Tales. And these start here in 1963 with Strange Tales 110 through 111 and also Strange Tales 115, where we are introduced in, I think it's 5-page backup stories in 110 and 111 and an 8-page backup story in 115 to Stan Lee and Steve Ditko's creation of Doctor Strange. And I have to say, I'm someone who, much like the Fantastic Four, Doctor Strange has never been a character that I've even slightly cared about, you know, as a modern-day comic book reader. But that being said, I honestly, guys, when I read him a few years ago and then when I read him again in preparation for this podcast, I wound up being really, really impressed and borderline blown away by this early Steve Ditko Doctor Strange. The art is just amazing. It gives him an opportunity to do things that, while perhaps we were seeing things previously in anthology titles involving like magic and the occult and stuff like that, in maybe some of your more horror-themed books, something that really feels unique and different, set against the typical superhero landscape that Marvel is quickly becoming dominated by. So I don't know if you guys dug these nearly as much as I did, but I loved the hell out of these Doctor Strange pages we got.
Ditto, or Ditko, if you will, because the three parts of Doctor Strange we read from these issues is what really put Ditko over the top for me, mm-hmm. as the best artist of this particular year. And like you guys, if you'll go back and listen to Marvel Masterclass, Ben and I discussed how Doctor Strange is just not a character that hits with either of us. We've tried some of his modern stuff and even the more recent Jason Aaron run. And you would think that, you know, Jason Aaron, a guy that I absolutely love, would have been able to make Doctor Strange more interesting to me. But I fell out of that series very quickly. And here I had very low expectations as a result of that. But reading it, I was enthralled. This, especially with this first tale, mm-hmm. of Doctor Strange, that is less superheroics and far more like noir mystery, mm-hmm. but with Ditko art. And that had me from the jump. Like, I loved every bit of this story. Like the mystery that builds around it, the methodology of Doctor Strange being a bit of a magical detective. The twist reveal at the end, though, a little underwhelming due to what the guy actually did to his colleagues or whatever, because I was expecting them to be dead. But it turns out, no, I just ruined them. Like, okay. And he was that guilt-ridden over it. It seems like a little bit of a shallow thing there at the end, but all the build-up to it was just so freaking good. And I'm looking, I guess Ditko did all of his own inking and coloring, but hot damn, it's good. Especially this, mm-hmm. I love this first panel of Doctor Strange. Like, mm-hmm. I love this look, that whole bit, all of this.
That first page, the bottom right panel with the guy lighting the cigarette and like shaking as he does it, it's tremendous. Fantastic. That holds up mm-hmm. today. Like, it's just great.
Yes. This looks like it would be right at home in Vertigo Comics, like, mm-hmm. Right alongside some Sandman stuff. Mm-hmm. So if you guys have read any of that, if you like that style of artwork, you need to read some Strange Tales.
And what about the pacing of this? Like, Ditko and Lee have five pages here, and these five pages feel like they would be entire story arcs or trades unto themselves these days. Like, these stories are just amazing, the amount of level of the detail they're able to cover in five pages and the amount of plot they're able to get through without it feeling overly expository in five pages. I was just impressed by this entire presentation from top to bottom. Todd, what were your thoughts?
This is so good for what it is. you can tell Ditko cared about it quite a bit.
Yes.
And there's the extra attention to detail and moodiness. I also think they really tap into the actual counterculture a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not just, you know, old men, not middle-aged men's idea of it. You do have something that just feels very different than the actual mainstream Marvel U. This actually, reading this the first time, reminded me quite a bit of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen trades by Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill. That art, it seems very, I don't know what the right word is, portrait based. I really like this. I was not expecting it to be as different and off. What's the word? Offbeat, mm-hmm. as it was, and enjoyed the nightmare aspect. I enjoyed the twist actually at the end just a little bit, but it did seem kind of like, well, you know, the punishment didn't necessarily fit the crime, what we were talking about. All the aspects are there, though, and you want to learn more about Doctor Strange, and you will in the very next issue, but it's nice to have him in media res. You already have this established character, at least in their eyes. You know, we're not given an origin story. We're just giving an interesting character, and we're asking the questions about the origin as we go.
Yeah, backing up the point that was made earlier, I think I have a lot of admiration for these, just for how short they are, but at the same time cramming so much in there and not feeling overly expository and not doing a whole big origin right from the jump. We don't get the origin until a couple issues later. I did feel like issue 110 was the standout to me as well. I kind of wish they'd stuck with that theme of, you know, just kind of these episodic sort of quick hits, that it's so moody, so atmospheric. And I was a little bit let down by the follow-up in 111, just because it felt like the art was a little bit sketchier, and the whole, like, astral fight deal between Strange and Mordo was kind of hokey.
I think
111's more for Mordo being introduced and showing that he's got an equal.
Yeah.
But the art bounces right back in 115. I think it's just as good as 110.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, Tim, because I was going to say that as much as I love all of these, like this whole Doctor Strange exploration, the Mordo issue was definitely the weak link in there to me.
I would agree with that. Yeah,
because it felt like stock superhero stuff just with magic, and I was already getting in the mood that Doctor Strange was going to be something super different from what we've been reading up to this point. But luckily, as you guys already pointed out, issue 115 kind of brings all of that back. I loved his origin story.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Tremendous Doctor Strange tale all over again. And it was remarkable to me as I was reading it how much of it felt like, if you go back and watch the movie, the recent movie, Doctor Strange, they pulled it directly from that issue from Strange Tales 115. They changed a few details here and there, but it's amazing how much of that is still pretty much exactly as it was in 63.
And, you know, Ditko is so good at the facial expressions and the close-ups, especially, that we have talked about. And you see a lot more of that, again, in this issue and the introduction in 110 as well. So that's where he especially shines. And we got that on full display here. So really strong stuff. And by the way, did you guys notice it's Doctor Strange. He is the master of black magic, not the mystic arts yet.
Yes.
I think that was intentional. Going with, like Todd alluded to, some of the counterculture of the time, like knowing that black magic was a thing that was like out there and kind of taboo in many circles, but also seen as cool by some of the like more college-aged and young adult kids at the time. So, no, I think that was very much intentional on Stan and Ditko's part.
Oh, they were definitely trying to appeal to that crowd with this character. And I would think they did a tremendous job of it. Like, if I were like in college in the 60s and I had read something like this, I feel like I definitely would have been like really into it. Like, all right, I need more of this because it's just so trippy and so fucking cool. And yet it's a detective story at its heart. So it's like, it's kind of checking all the boxes.
Guys, I got to confess, I was taken aback a bit aback. I didn't know that the we read this issue 110 for Doctor Strange. I was thinking it was notable because of the Paste Pot Pete story.
gotcha.
Yeah, that's true. These installments are coming on the back of what are Human Torch solo spotlights in Strange Tales, the anthology title. And we sort of have skipped over those just because there's not a lot to say about them.
Yeah, we're really trying to hit the high points of Marvel continuity, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you guys know of it, but I can't think of anything really meaningful that came out of Strange Tales Human Torch solo features in the front halves.
No.
You mean you don't want to read about his taking on of the Asbestos Man?
It is notable to
now the
see
Asbestos
that.
Man definitely has mesothelioma, I would have to think.
you can see that they were trying to push him as the teenage character.
Yeah, the point of view character
to
grab
onto. Nobody else on the Fantastic Four had solo stories.
Right. Well, and there is also the Captain America fake out in 115, where you get an imposter Captain America before the character's re-debut in an issue we will not be talking about this episode.
No. It's kind of like Clayface being the Red Hood or being Jason Todd in Hush.
Mm.
Yep. Like a tryout. Let's see if the public is ready for this character yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's actually a great segue, Tim, because you mentioned, we're not going to see Captain America's debut in this episode. We're not going to talk about it in this episode anyway, but that happened in the pages of a little book called Avengers. And 1963 is notable for having the first issue of the Avengers. So Avengers number one, one of two huge number ones that we're going to talk about to close out this episode of Marvel Age. And let's jump right into it here. Avengers number one, I had not read in a long time, guys. I don't even know that I read it a few years ago when I was doing this as a solo reading project. I had forgotten how much of a Thor-focused story this was. And as a result of that, I think I probably wound up enjoying it more than I actually should have. Because I'm going to be honest, anytime Thor wasn't the primary driver of action, anytime we were focused on Iron Man or Hulk or especially Ant-Man and the Wasp, I found myself just kind of rolling my eyes and wanting to get to the next bit featuring Thor, because I thought all the Thor stuff, and especially Jack Kirby getting to draw Asgard here and do the Land of the Trolls and stuff like that, Kirby was clearly super into the Thor mythology. And it was kind of disappointing for this reading list. We didn't have any Journey into Mystery, but I feel like this issue of Avengers kind of fills that role anyway. So I wound up liking this one, but I think I liked it more than it deserved to be liked, if that makes any sense.
It does. I am absolutely with you. Anytime Thor was on panel driving the action, as you put it, this was actually pretty enjoyable. A little bit of the Iron Man stuff was kind of fun, but for the most part, this should have just been a straight up Thor story because everything else lacks any kind of like real interest. The whole like Rick Jones and his little team group.
Oh my god!
Was one of the single worst ideas, concepts, and executions that has ever been in any superhero comic ever, and that is saying something.
As someone who's read a lot of that Justice League of America stuff, so much of Marvel in this time frame is managing to avoid the mistakes that DC is making. But Rick Jones is one of those things where they are just making the same fucking mistakes, because Rick Jones and Snapper Carr are the same character and they are insufferable in every appearance they ever make. Like, just the worst.
And this is just the Newsboy Legion, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't know.
Exactly what I was going to say. 100% it's the Newsboy Legion.
But not...
There's more diversity in the Newsboy Legion, at least in...
Yeah, this is just a group of, like, five white kids standing around with listening devices. And it's... And only two of them really speak.
Backstreet's back.
It is so fucking terrible. They serve no real purpose in the story. They're just there to, I guess, give some kind of like regular person in.
The only thing they can bring to the story, I think, is they are used as a plot device to explain why the Fantastic Four is not handling this problem, and they are building a new super team alongside the Fantastic Four. Because they actually – part of the story is that the Teen Brigade is trying to reach out to the Fantastic Four to fight the Hulk, knowing they have experience with the Hulk or whatever, and instead the Avengers show up. Or not the Avengers. Yeah. Thor and Iron Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp, who wound up calling themselves the Avengers by the end of the episode. Episode.
And the thing is, when you get there and how conveniently everything is wrapped up, it's like, wow, we just kind of sailed through all this stuff, didn't we? Hulk's loner issues all seem to be taken care of as well. Still, I did like the – I love the idea of Loki as their first villain. But
Loki's
I gotta say,
the star of the show.
Yeah, Loki is the – Loki and Thor are the stars of this. Also, if you'll notice, they're starting to work in a little bit of that Asgardian accent into Thor's dialogue.
Yep.
He's not quite there yet, but it's starting to slip in ever so gradually. So I think that Stan Lee is starting to steer that character – towards being more like the Thor that we know from the modern day. And if he keeps on this path, I think it won't be long before he becomes that.
And Ben Morris on Masterclass, the companion to this show officially, talked about how Stan Lee had this disdain for teenage sidekick characters.
Yeah,
and you just wish he had sort of followed his instinct.
Yes,
with this and the whole team brigade thing, and I don't even know. I'm not sure why he felt the need necessarily to even create Rick Jones, or if maybe he had another purpose in mind for Rick Jones. I don't know, but even without the Hulk having his own series, we're still getting Rick Jones, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like. You know, we'll cover this in subsequent years, but it's not like they realized their mistake with Rick Jones and he went away. Rick Jones stayed around for a long time for no reason. Like, they kept trying to make that character work in a way that he just never did.
No.
Rick Jones is still around.
Yeah, and like you guys, Nick, you really took the words out of my mouth by pumping up the Thor aspects of this. It does feel like it could be an issue of Journey into Mystery, but with various other notable guest stars just joining Thor. And it becomes that battle on two fronts, where you have Thor doing the much, much more intriguing part of this story and looking for Loki in Asgard and the adventure that entails from that. But then you have Iron Man, Ant-Man, and the Wasp dealing with the Hulk back on Earth. And that doesn't quite come together in the way it ought to. Yeah, the Iron Man stuff is okay.
We need to talk about fake robot clown Hulk.
Yeah, we do.
Oh, boy, talk about a part of this issue that felt like it was really going off the rails. How did Avengers become a thing with that? At least they abandoned it, right?
Yeah, I mean, if it was tying into the Circus of Crime and the Ringmaster, circuses oog me out anyway. But
right. No, yeah, I know.
What a bizarre story, part of the story.
It was like, wow, they were just trying to figure out some way to have Hulk hiding in plain sight, I guess. And this was your first thought. All right. Sometimes Lee and Kirby are not the strongest of collaborators. And this would be one of those instances. It's like when Stan Lee is bouncing ideas off of other people, like Steve Ditko, for example, you get some really great things like Amazing Spider-Man or Doctor Strange. But when he starts bouncing ideas off of Jack Kirby, you get weird-ass shit like a fake robot Hulk. And I'm wondering, what is the deal with these two as collaborators versus Stan Lee and Steve Ditko? Why are they having trouble finding that same magic? Because they're not consistent. They're turning out some good issues, some good stuff in there, like we saw in the Fantastic Four annual. Well, but there's a lot of times where you get some real shit.
I think Fantastic Four is the industry standard. It's the mega hit of this point. And so they're trying to tweak the formulas as much as they can, or just a little bit, and crank out new characters here and there. Maybe they are overexposed here. They're just putting out so much content that
you had a lot more output from.
And Stan's his own editor at this point, right?
Yeah,
and basically. He shouldn't be, but I'm sure that there weren't exactly a ton of job openings at Marvel at this point.
Yeah. I mean, the concept is great. You have – it's just like Justice League. You put all the top characters – well, it's not, because if it was just like Justice League, Spider-Man would be in the Avengers, right?
Yeah.
Your top characters would be in there. It's this ones that don't quite have – I ones that could be better served in a team where the personalities to play off can make up for how – say the Hulk isn't always that interesting on his own. But so it's a great idea in concept, but the execution takes a while. And we'll see that in 1964, where they bring in something that really changes the direction of the Avengers. But this first issue is just kind of an excuse to get them together and have that cover with all your favorite Marvel heroes who aren't Spider-Man or the Fantastic Four on the same team.
Well, and you also have to consider Lee and Ditko were doing Spider-Man, and just recently, and in very short bursts, Doctor Strange. Meanwhile, Lee and Kirby are doing Fantastic Four. They're doing The Incredible Hulk, which we already described was a little bit of a miss. Ant-Man, again, more of a miss. And so that's already, like, what, about really 3/5 of your Avengers when you count the Wasp. You did have Thor, which worked very, very well, and unsurprisingly gives us the best segment of this issue. So, I don't know. It's just kind of, I think, what you would expect from the characters that are spotlighted here. It just kind of depends. Iron Man, which Kirby had not worked on, but maybe they're still trying to find their footing a bit with him. I will say that the whole super-powered transistors thing, arc reactor, that is not.
No. That was the state-of-the-art of the time, was the transistors, mm-hmm. The solid-state tech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have Iron Man in his gold armor, so no longer Battleship Gray like in his debut. And he will continue to evolve. So it's, still feeling it out.
It's undoubtedly worked out for all parties involved, given the benefit of hindsight. But at the time, does it not feel weird that Spider-Man was not a part of the Avengers? Like, looking back on it now, is it something that probably should have happened, given the landscape of things?
Ditko maybe saying, don't
fucking do that. Baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that, Todd. I could see Ditko being like, not so sure about all this. But given the landscape and given how popular Spider-Man was, it does seem really strange that he wasn't a founding member of the Avengers. I mean, they went for Ant-Man and the Wasp. Could you imagine how much better this might have been if they had said, maybe Ant-Man and the Wasp sucks. Let's bring in Spider-Man instead.
Maybe, but I can see some value in keeping Spider-Man siloed from the rest of the Marvel Universe as it's developing. You know, it really ups the idea that he is the odd man out.
And that's a good point. That's a great point, Tim.
That's kind of the direction they go with. We already saw it, in the very first issue of ASM, where he tries to join the Fantastic Four and is like, this isn't going to work. So we're getting at the idea that he's not necessarily a team player, and I mean, he's already so young and has to develop into a superhero in his own right, and you want that development to be tracked in his own series. So, you know, whether it's Ditko or whether it's Lee kind of recognizing that, I don't know, but at least from the outset, I think we are better off without Spider-Man. Now, as the series drags on, you can make a case that maybe he ought to join this team or had a decent go at it before, what was it, 2004 in New Avengers? So
yeah, Civil War era.
Quite a long stretch of time without Spider-Man as a member of this team. Impressive in its way.
Indeed. So, yeah. Any final thoughts on Avengers number one before we move on to the other massive number one of 1963? Mm. Hearing none. Let's move on to the other big debut. That, of course, being Uncanny? Question mark? X-Men number one? And I only add that question mark based on the first episode of Marvel Age Masterclass, which you can listen to right now on Place to Be Nation. Pop. So here we are, X-Men number one. I could say so many things, but why not turn it over to the man himself? Take it away, Mr. Tim Capel.
I first read this comic in a reprint form.
Amazing Adventures.
No, it was actually a single issue reprint that was published in, I could tell you the year by knowing, when did the Addams Family movie come out?
93, 92?
91, 92, I think. So anyway, it was on the stands at the time that movie was released, because I can remember going to the comic shop across from my apartment before going to see that movie. I don't know why I have that memory, I just do. And it was not, you know, an issue I expected to see just kind of sitting on the stands. I guess I basically realized it was a reprint because I wasn't even... being the 10-year-old that I was, I don't think I was naive enough to think that X-Men, retroactively Uncanny X-Men number one from 1963, was just randomly available in such great condition for all of, you know, $1.95. It just didn't really track. So I went ahead and picked this up at the time, and I really loved it on that first rereading. So I've always had that kind of affection for this series from the number one. I think I've always been a bit of a mark for the original X-Men. Although their Silver Age adventures are not the best. It's sort of proto X-Men in a way, but because of my own, preference, I guess, for the original five, I've always had a soft spot for it. And I just think it is, when you get into the issue itself, it is such maybe almost an unintentional stroke of genius on the part of Stan Lee to come up with this concept that, all right, we don't have individual origins for all of these characters where they gain superpowers. They're just born with them. You know, that was in his own tellings of how he came up with the idea for the X-Men. It was just a shorthand as a writer, because he was already bogged down with creating all these new characters and feeling obligated to do real origin stories for them, that he just said, the hell with it, let's just say they were born with their powers. And I'm not doing a Stan Lee impression, because mine is not very good. And so it opens up, even though it's this kind of form of shorthand that he's using, it ends up in the long run paying dividends, because it opens up just this world of possibilities where you now have, all right, we have superheroes who get their powers through an accident, right? Like the traditional superhero origin story. And then we have these guys who are just naturally bestowed with powers, and what does that mean for the human race? And you get into all the metaphor, which, you know, kind of comes about later. But even here, we have the concept of, you know, quote unquote, good mutants versus evil mutants. And so while the things that probably hold the most appeal to me as a fan of the X-Men are not necessarily here, the bones of it are, at least. So I don't know what you guys made of this, or if you'd encountered the very first issue of X-Men / Uncanny X-Men prior to the podcast, but I've always really dug this one.
Professor X has always been a jerk.
Yep. This is true.
He's an asshole. Jean Grey gets about 6 or 7 Me Too moments.
Her
first few minutes with this new team.
Which,
speaking of Me Too, all those folks who are really pissed off about Iceman being revealed as gay in the modern context, guys, go back and read X-Men #1 from 63 and tell me that character's not gay.
Maybe it's because of the recent controversy that it was fresh on my mind, but that just jumps out at you. Like,
he's totally...
That had to be intentional on Stan's part, right?
I would think so, because they say he's a 16-year-old kid.
Exactly.
He's younger than me.
Exactly.
Like, but he's 16. I'm like, you want to show me a 16-year-old boy, American boy, who's not a boy in general, who is not horny as fuck all the time.
Exactly. And like, it's clearly
straight gay.
And the intention is to clearly depict Jean Grey as like this picture of beauty, like this super desirable, you know, girl or whatever, and he has no interest whatsoever. Like, I'm not saying that every female has to be, you know, attractive to every male, but in this, you know, more generalized form of comic book writing, guys, like, I think it was right there. Tim, am I crazy in this?
I'm just going to say that it's easy to fill that in based on the characterization here. I don't think that was the intention. I'm not saying that, ooh, it's not Stan Lee's intent. I can't believe, you know, that's not what I'm doing at all. I think it's a great long overdue development that they finally pulled the trigger on that, right? But if we're getting into what was the intent, I don't think so. I think he was just supposed to be written as extremely young, extremely immature, and it's Stan not necessarily having the best handle on how to write teenagers.
Yeah, so I guess if they were going to go that route, though, he probably should have been like 12 to 14 instead of 16. I guess what Russell and I are hung up on is you call him out as being 16, and to me that just – that's like the age that epitomizes complete horn dog. You know what I mean? Like, and to have him be so disinterested, it feels intentional. False. It feels
there are three other teenagers in the Marvel universe. There's Rick Jones. Is he all over girls?
No, he's all over.
No, very Bruce. Clearly all over Bruce.
There's Human Torch, who might be.
Oh,
it's might be there.
Very clearly all over Spider-Man.
He kind of also has an ick girls moment between Reed and Sue in one of the issues that we looked at. We didn't really talk about, but...
But then he also takes...
He's sort of like, I don't really get it.
Well, that's because it's his sister. Like, that's what
not
I took out of that.
Really.
Because they have that in a subsequent issue, he's taking a girl to his favorite parking spot or whatever. Like,
yeah, we do see him on dates later on.
Like, and he's very clearly trying to sow his royal oats, so to speak. Peter's deal is that not so much that he's not interested, it's just that he's really bad with girls. Like, that has always been the aspect of it. Whereas, I'll grant you...
We haven't seen that at this point yet.
True.
He wants to work on his lab stuff, or he's worrying about Aunt May.
Yeah.
Yeah, Peter is so gloriously distracted by everything horrible going on in his life that it's kind of killed any libido that he might have had budding up.
I guess what I'm driving at is this is the only time we've really seen a teenage character just seem wholly disinterested in like sex as a concept, I guess is what I'm saying.
Not to keep harping on this subject, and to kind of segue into some other like weird characterizations in this issue, there are two that stand out. One is that Beast is written basically the same as Ben Grimm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And yep. That I found that very off-putting.
Well, this whole team is kind of a Fantastic Four
ripoff.
It's not a
archetypes.
It's yeah archetypes,
personality exactly. Archetypes.
Like Iceman is Human Torch, Beast is Ben Grimm. Sure. You know, Scott Summers is Mr. Fantastic.
Who?
Excuse me, Slim Summers is
Slim Mr. Summers.
Yeah, yeah, Tim, what's the deal with Slim Summers here?
She calls him Slim right away.
Yeah,
second panel, she meets him.
He's introduced as Professor Slim X. Summers by Professor X. We get no, and look, a lot of these things are going to change very quickly. And
sure.
By that, I mean like the third issue. Yes. We see that Beast is actually quite intelligent, and that Slim is actually a nickname for Scott. So much of this stuff is sort of a the television pilot of what the series will be. So that changes pretty fast. Jean Grey, Marvel Girl, is the token female member of the team in much the way that Sue Storm is in Fantastic Four. She does kind of hold her own and give it back to these lecherous older boys.
She seems older than the Wasp.
She does seem quite older than the Wasp.
That's true.
So, but I don't know. I just kind of read it as Beast and Angel are kind of the older kids around the same age as Jean, and they're, you know, just fawning all over her. And Bobby is the sort of just annoying kid brother who, and you got to keep in mind, Stan Lee is 25 years removed from being this age, I think,
yeah,
at this point in writing the series.
It's like Mark Waid writing the Champions.
you bring up Angel, Tim. Go ahead, Russell.
I was going to say that one other little hint here about Bobby is that in the very first scene with him, the very first time you see him on page, pretty sure that he has made his own little stripper pole here that he's swinging around on. So there's that.
You bring up Angel, though,
yeah,
Tim.
Yeah, the interesting ice constructs are on full display here.
If you're drawing analogs to the Fantastic Four, is Angel not kind of the odd person out? Like, he doesn't really have a clear, direct parallel to the Fantastic Four.
A little bit. So it's not – I mean, and there's, you know, five of them versus six if you count Professor X and mm-hmm. just four of Fantastic Four. And they get at this idea of – not so much in this issue, but the shades are there of a love triangle with Jean and Slim and Warren. And it's kind of funny because in this particular love triangle, Warren is Scott and Scott is Logan. So because from all indications, she would be like the couple would be Jean and Warren. And that's just not how it's going to play out. So I don't know. That'll be something to track as this goes along.
Well, somebody else reveals their love for Jean very, very soon. In the
Ah, oh, yes.
God. Oh, my God.
Yep.
Something else that was also seen through to its full fruition in the Ultimate Universe, unfortunately. In any event, so this issue, the contents of it as a whole, I got to say, like, the opening bit with the training sequence and stuff doesn't really do much for me. But once Magneto comes into play, I think the issue really kind of takes off. And the back half of the issue winds up being pretty damn entertaining, by my standards anyway. I know we've talked a lot about the characters and stuff. What did you guys make of this one from a plotting perspective?
Pretty good overall. I mean, once you get past the initial the montage or training bits where we're introducing the characters, and you get into the actual like Magneto side of it, like you were saying, that's when this issue really starts to sing, because I feel like even though he's you know, a bit monologue-y as the villains tended to be in this era. Magneto is still less so than some of his counterparts in other comics from the time. And his motivations are at least, you know, interesting. They're far more interesting than, like, some of the motivations of, say, anyone who is, like, trying to get a big stack of money or something. He's genuinely out there fighting for his race. And that's going to bring him, of course, into conflict with military, with humans, and with apparently with other mutants. And I found all of that to be remarkably well done and very well drawn from Jack Kirby. I actually really liked his art on this issue.
Mm-hmm. I like his Magneto a lot.
Yes, I was a big fan of it. The only thing I would have changed a little bit was I've always said this about Magneto's look, is I prefer him not to have that kind of protruding emblem on the helmet. I prefer that more like the sleek look, but the cape and everything else and the color work on him was outstanding. So he's a, if you'll forgive the pun, a very magnetic character that you can't help but be drawn to.
Oh, and Stan Lee loves magnets. He, like, yes, second only to radiation as magic. And here's a character that is, his entire gimmick is based around magnets. So he definitely cut loose on that.
And he understands about as much about magnetism as he understands about radiation. But it's neither really, it's not really here nor there. It's still just fun stuff.
Oh yeah, it's so much fun. Did you like Magneto's? What is it called? Like air signing, where he makes his demands of the military by, he's using what, like metallic filaments, I guess, in the sky.
Who knows? It was cool though.
Yep,
it's a cool moment.
Cursive.
I love how how he signs his proper name in cursive. Yeah.
Yes.
Surrender, Dorothy.
And it's.
It's so extra. I love it.
It's totally a thing of its time.
I love Lucy.
I got to diverge from Russell here. I actually like the protruded, like, horn emblem thing on Magneto's helmet. It's something I've always dug from this era. I will call out there on page 22 where Kirby just randomly doesn't draw it on the helmet. If you look at the bottom right panel of page 22, it's there in the top right panel of that page, and it's gone in the bottom right panel of that page. So, just another example of inconsistencies throughout these early books. Doesn't seem like there's a strong editorial presence, if you know what I mean. So, Todd, you haven't said a whole lot about the plot of this one. What'd you think?
It's, you know, you go back and look at how you'll read many more comics like this, but this is the first with the teenage team, actual team of teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you had a teen team. You didn't have Teen Titans. Maybe you did in the Brave and the Bold, but they were all sidekicks. They weren't a unique team of heroes. So I like that aspect as an original, very different thing. Certainly you have the FF archetypes of personalities, but the powers are different enough that they're very interesting. They're somewhat freakish. I mean, you can say Angel is super good looking, but he has these wings. Jean Grey is not necessarily a freak in any sense of the word, but, you know, we use this metaphor that was later kind of moved in for Homo Superior taking over. And I feel that this issue is good, too great. But the best aspect about it is the Magneto thing. Mm-hmm. I think you get a fully formed villain right from the get-go. You understand what he's after. You have the great character design and a fantastic power set, too. So I think that's to me, the, not just do you have the X-Men's first appearance, but you have Magneto's, just as importantly. And I think they got most of it right from the get-go, with the characters and the personalities and the design. I love that they had matching uniforms, too. I've for years and years, and I love when the New Mutants, years later, would kind of appropriate those as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it's another one of those things where I'm more interested to read the follow-up. like once now that they've got all the characters set up for the X-Men themselves out of the way, I'm more interested in reading 1964's X-Men, even though I liked this one issue of X-Men that we read in 1963. So
yeah, it reads more as a pilot than some of the other number one issues.
Yeah, and Tim and Tim touched on that, and that's a great point. So
yeah, it's a lot like when you're watching those Marvel Netflix shows. That first episode might be more set up than it is substantive, but the longer this goes, the better it's going to get.
Which will be interesting to track because, you know, X-Men is one of those things that has a reputation for not really working in its initial incarnation.
Yes, and you can sort of see why that would be the case, but in other areas I felt like it was, if anything, a little bit ahead of its time.
And maybe that's the reason why it didn't work.
Maybe, so we will definitely have to track that as we go along. And, you know, kudos to this. We're introducing not just the team and their personalities and their costumes, their powers, but their who would become their arch nemesis as well. You don't often get all of that in your very first outing from the jump.
Agreed. So with all that being said, that brings an end to our reading list for this year of 1963 here in our second episode. So before we move on to our you know, our end-of-year awards that we like to give out here on the show, let's go through some final thoughts on 63, and I'll kind of give mine right here. When we started the show, we talked about how a lot of us weren't really anticipating big leaps forward in terms of quality, and yet I kind of feel like that's what we got across the board. Like, I feel even the extremely low points like Tales to Astonish or Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos didn't quite hit some of the lows that 1961 through 1962 did, whereas the highs were just even higher highs. Stan was better from a writing and plotting standpoint. Jack Kirby in particular was locked in at this point, and the art just took off. And here we get to see an expanded role for Steve Ditko in the expanding Marvel Universe, and he is just a tour de force at this point. So I have to say, I wasn't expecting it, but I think 1963 as a whole, at least based on what we read, big step up creatively and qualitatively from 1961, 1962. Todd?
Definitely. You had the chance for some longer form storytelling. You got some callbacks where characters were actually developed a little bit, and you got to see them take a few more risks with characters like Doctor Strange and the X-Men.
Absolutely. Russell?
I am pretty much on board with everything that you just said, Nick. This was not the year that I expected it to be. Like it, huge jump in quality, and even though there were still some real lows in there, they weren't nearly as low as the previous year. But this was the moment where I started to really start like picking out some of my favorites, and even discovered some new ones that have me really interested to go back and read some more of this stuff, like to continue on with some of these characters even outside of our reading list. So 1963, way better than 61 and 62. I got emotionally invested in some of these characters. So yeah, there's a good bit of fun stuff happening here. It's making this project even more fun now that we're starting to get into the meat, the meat and potatoes of some of these characters that we've known and loved for all these years. So big ups on 1963. Can't wait to see where we go from here.
Absolutely. Tim?
We now have, with the conclusion of this year, the foundation of the Marvel superhero shared universe. With maybe one exception, there's one debut away from that, which we will get to in short order. But yeah, just like everyone else said, this is not a tremendous number of issues that we covered, but a ton of story, just so much packed into this. And I always forget for some reason that Fantastic Four debuted in 61, and they are now, you know, how many issues deep by the end of the year? The last issue we covered was, what, 17? And that, I think they have a couple of
that
more.
That was in August of 63, 17 would have been, which means that they would have been to about 20 or 21. Let's see, Fantastic Four 25 is in April of 64, so do the math backwards from there. So yeah, 21, yeah. I believe, by the end of the year.
21's the last one, yeah. Yeah. Featuring Greg Phillips' favorite villain, the Hate Monger.
Ah! Oh,
very good. So that's one of those things that this is sort of the standard bearer, right? You've got FF, and then you've sort of got these other characters and these other series that are coming along. But even in the early goings, Spider-Man hits so hard. We've already talked about Thor and Journey into Mystery, which we haven't seen a lot of that character in this year, but he was the highlight of the debuting Avengers, which we only had the one issue to go on, but a lot of potential and room to grow. X-Men, brand new concept, so still Stan and Jack hitting it out of the gate, trying to throw everything at the wall to see what's going to stick. Doctor Strange that we've talked about and been so complimentary of. So even though they're superheroes, there's different hooks for all of them. And, I mean, we only had a couple of dogs here and, you know, take a shot, Ant-Man. And Sergeant Fury didn't really hit with us. But I think a lot of that just has to do with the fact that we aren't huge fans of, like, war comics.
Yeah. We're here for the superheroes, not for the war stuff.
Yep. And, you know, we're getting the emergence of the Marvel trade dress as well that I think Todd referenced earlier. So not quite the Marvel bullpen that's going to be hyped up so heavily. We don't have Stan's soapbox, but if you look at the letters pages of Fantastic Four, they have a special announcements section where they talk about the other publications under the now Marvel banner. So we're getting to see more of that swagger. And that's something that that I kind of dig.
Ah, great to hear. Great to hear, Tim. Well, let's wrap up the show here as we did with our first episode by giving out some end-of-year awards. I'm actually going to throw you guys a little bit of a curveball with a couple of new categories we're going to introduce here. And let's start with Russell. Russell, I'm going to ask you for your hero or heroes of the year. I mean, heroes... I'm leaving you out there in case you wanted to count, for example, the Fantastic Four as a unit or something like that. But I basically, you're protagonist of the year.
Protagonist of the year, I think you got to give it to Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Those three issues of Amazing Spider-Man really developed the character in some big, bad ways. We get into the real heart and meat of this character. He goes through some real shit, but still comes out on the other side of it, shining and smelling of roses, at least is the best he could. He's truly the example of the everyman hero doing the best he can with what he's got. So, and I can't help but want to read more and more of his stuff. So, yeah, Amazing Spider-Man is my pick for Hero of the Year.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with all of that. Go ahead and throw mine out there. It's also Spider-Man. We talked about this earlier, but if you want to talk about relatability and real-world feel in the Marvel Universe, look no further than Peter Parker and his initial forays here in 1963. So I'm going to co-sign everything Russell said, and I'm going to give it to Spider-Man as well. Tim, what about your hero or heroes of the year?
I'm going to back you guys up. Give it to Peter Palmer.
Well done.
What about Todd?
Gabriel, the horn blower from... No, of course it's Spider-Man. It's a clean sweep. Most interesting things being done and the most growth as a character. And just this awesome hero.
Outstanding. Along the same lines, Todd, we'll start with you. What about your villain or antagonist of the year? This is a little bit tougher.
This is a little tougher. I'm going to go ahead and say it's Doctor Doom... just for different reasons. His look is still good. You have the bizarre appearance in issue 10 with the fourth wall being broken and then the two-parter. Clearly, Stan and Jack knew that they had quite the nemesis for the Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom, and soon he would cross over into other titles as well.
Good choice. Good choice. Tim, what about you?
I'm actually going to have to say Namor.
Hmm.
Yeah, just because we get, gosh, we get that great annual, mm-hmm. that story, which, and there's so much more to him than just being a straight up villain. And you can use him in just a multitude of ways. Like, he's a bruiser. He can stand toe-to-toe with the Thing, which is always fun to see. He's also that kind of romantic rival. And he's this supposed conquering warlord who has an entire army to back up his agenda to overthrow the surface world. You know, his personality can be quite fun as well. You know, so
arrogant, and yeah,
over the top. So yeah, I, you know, just because of just all the different ways and the different stories he can be plugged into, I have to give it to Namor.
And I'm going to jump in here again and co-sign what Tim just said. Mainly because we only got one story that featured him during this year, this reading list for 1963. But it was a story that, like I said earlier, felt like payoff. It felt like something that had been built to over the entirety of 1961 and 1962, you know, with the previous Namor appearances. And this just felt epic. It was the first of these issues that just really felt huge and important. And that whole annual issue is just so fantastic. Everything that Namor does in it is great. So even though he only has the one appearance, I'm gonna give it to Namor, who slightly, very slightly, edges out the character that I think Russell's gonna go with.
I'm gonna give it to Hank Pym for being a real piece of shit pedophile and ruining good comics. No. He's just an asshole. He's not a villain. Actually, I'm co-signing on the Namor line.
Oh, wow. Okay. I thought for sure you'd go Doc Ock.
I was close on that one,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, that was my only real competition here.
Yeah, same.
I was close on that one, but Doc Ock, having only had his one appearance and not being, like, really fully developed, like he's only had this one shot at it, I got to give it to Namor. For all the reasons you guys said, that Fantastic Four annual was just too good. Too good. Cannot be topped as far as a villain-centric story. And a sympathetic villain at that, which is something that we haven't seen very much of. But there again, Doc Ock was close on that one too. But Namor's story in this one will really kind of hit you in the heart. So, yeah. Not a clean sweep this time, but damn close. Namor is the best villain this year.
Agreed. I don't even think we need to have this discussion, but I'm assuming we're all going with Stan Lee as our writer of the year, unless somebody wants to go wildly off script and go Larry Lieber or random pseudonym dude who wrote that issue of Tales to Astonish.
More like Fails to Astonish.
Yes.
So we're all going Stan, correct, as our writer of the year.
We're all stands for Stan.
And I'm also going to refer to Tales to Astonish as Fails to Astonish from here on out.
So Stan is writer of the year, but here we go. This is the one that might be a little bit more interesting. I know where I'm going. I think I know where Russell's going, but I'm going to go ahead and throw it out there. Artist of the year for me, and I'm going to say it. I don't think it's all – as much as I love what Kirby did this year, I don't think it's altogether close, at least based on my personal preferences for art. I'm giving it to Steve Ditko. I was so tempted based on strictly Amazing Fantasy 15 last year and some of the backup stories that we read in some of those anthology books to give it to Ditko. But this year, with the advent of Doctor Strange, with the full-length Spider-Man tales, I just think that the things that Ditko are doing are so ahead of their time for 1963. The facial expressions, the emotional visual storytelling, I was blown away by everything Steve Ditko did in this year. He is far and away my artist of the year. Todd, let's go to you.
There may never be a closer year for this award. I think Kirby's both of his innovations of bringing in new characters, designing them, drawing their debut issues. There I go again. But the actual execution of work in those first few iconic episode, I did it again, issues of Amazing Spider-Man, and in particular the revelatory first five-page Doctor Strange story from Strange Tales 110. I picked Ditko for this year, but it is closer to me than, say, what you were saying. I think some of the things that Kirby did with particularly the annual and in the pages of Fantastic Four overall, I think were extremely strong. But it was more of kind of a progression for him where we've seen this level from him before. It's just he's getting to stretch out a little bit. Ditko, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Especially just that line work, that ink work on Doctor Strange, where it was so moody. Such a different thing compared to every other story we've read at this point.
Yeah.
So there it is.
Wow. Okay. I was expecting Todd to go Kirby, but he went Ditko. Tim, what are you going to do here?
Well, I'll break it up and I guess probably be odd man out in here and say Kirby.
Okay.
And just for quality plus quantity. And
there you go.
Everything he has done in this year has felt inspired. Nothing phoned in. I mean, even when you're getting Kirby not on his A game, it's still Jack Kirby, but everything he touches here just really shines. And again, the diversity, so many different stories that are being told, and even bouncing from superheroes to war comics to even trash like Ant-Man and Tales to Astonish. I mean, if nothing else, at least it's still Kirby artwork. So it carries some otherwise perhaps shaky stories. So I've got to give it to the king.
Okay. And Russell, I think I know where you're going here, but take it away.
Gonna ditto on the Ditko.
Nope.
That, as I said throughout this show, he is it. For all the reasons that Nick said, his facial expressions, his attention to details. It's little stuff, really, but his action scenes, how he can be both gritty and like almost flamboyantly colorful at times in the same issue. I mean, go back and read any Amazing Spider-Man issue from this year, 1 through 3, it doesn't matter. They're all like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you factor in his Doctor Strange work, which is mind-blowing. It really is. And this is coming from somebody who never dug on Doctor Strange before. Never. And then I read this, and I'm like, I feel like I just need to read more of this. I feel like I need to spend the rest of my night reading a whole bunch of Doctor Strange from this era. As I've said on the Marvel Masterclass, I don't think it's going to work out long-term between me and Doctor Strange, but I'm in for a short little fling, as it were. And it's all on Steve Ditko's art.
I will say that, Russell, I got about 4 years into this project, 4 to 5 years into this project when I did it earlier, a while back. And yeah. I never read any Doctor Strange that I didn't enjoy. I'll put it that way. This early stuff, as long as Ditko is on the is on the book, it's outstanding in my opinion. So with that being said, Ditko, we're kind of split a little bit. Tim goes Kirby, the rest of us go Ditko. Here's the one I'm really interested in. Let's go issue of the year, and I will start again, and I will say, as I was working my way through this reading list and kind of building my ranking of issues, I read Amazing Spider-Man number 3, and I thought to myself, there is no way I will read anything else on this list that I enjoy as much as this. And then the Fantastic Four annual came along, and I realized how completely wrong I was. As great as Amazing Spider-Man 3 is, and it's the one that is closest to me for this, as I said earlier, the first Fantastic Four annual is not just good for 1963, it's good from a modern context. It is the closest thing I've read during this project to something like an original graphic novel would be today. It tells a story that is epic in scope, that feels like it's been built to, that feels like it is earned, and feels like it has stakes, has character development, has all these great moments, whether they be action, humor, or drama. It is, for my money anyway, the finest issue we have read thus far as part of this project. So for me, I give all the glory to Fantastic Four Annual number 1. What about you, Tim?
I'm glad you mentioned Amazing Spider-Man number 3. I'm glad you mentioned and gave it to Fantastic Four Annual 1, because that's what it came down to for me as well. And it was close. And I will say that I love Fantastic Four Annual 1 for everything it represents and for all the reasons you described and we talked about earlier. But I had to go with ASM number 3, a little bit surprising myself, in fact. It's just, it's so solid top to bottom. And you've got, we didn't talk about this a great deal, but it's the first appearance of one of the all-time great iconic Spider-Man villains in Dr. Octopus. Pound for pound, it's kind of like the best action comic we've read thus far as well, I felt like. Some good fight scenes between these characters. And you've got the protagonist catching them hands and, you know, being served this utter defeat. So more of that's learning what it means to be a superhero. We've already gotten some of the life lesson stuff with, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. But now just the day-to-day, what does it mean to be a hero in the Marvel Universe? You know, you're going to get your ass kicked from time to time, and you just get back on the horse. So, I don't know, just that formative development of Peter Palmer / Parker and Spider-Man, now Spider-Man with the hyphen, I enjoyed so very much. This is the type of thing you would kind of expect to see in one of the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies, where he just gets an absolute ass-kicking and has to come back from that. But just so much good character work here, and the Ditko arc that we have heaped praise on as well. I had to go ASM number 3.
A little surprising to hear that. Todd, what did you have as your issue of the year?
As good as Amazing Spider-Man number 3 was, and it's clearly the best issue of Spider-Man we've had
yes.
to date, with a beginning, a middle, and end, an actual arc for the character. Mm-hmm. Nothing changed the industry as much as the first Fantastic Four annual, where you were able to do just this truly epic story, give extended flashback sequences to characters and stories, introduce new characters, new motivations for these characters, plus pay off this 2-year-long character arc for Namor that's been building. So, in addition, you have the quote-unquote DVD extras that this issue gave you, plus a story from The Amazing Spider-Man meeting the Fantastic Four. Fantastic Four Annual number 1 is the thing I will take the most out of from 1983, and Sasha, my puppy dog, is here on mic with me now. So, hello, girl. You're a good girl.
Well, there's that. And Russell, let's go to you, who I think is – I'm interested to hear because we have varying opinions here. I think it's probably the same final two for you as well.
It was. It was down to Amazing Spider-Man number 3 and the Fantastic Four Annual number 1. And it's not really close when it comes to the rest of their competition. It was those two mm-hmm. issues. But as Todd pointed out, the Fantastic Four Annual number 1 was a game changer. Things – there's before this and there's after this. So I got to give it to the FF Annual number 1. That whole story is just intriguing. It has real stakes. You get super invested into this character of Namor. Just everything that happens from the incredible action drawn by Jack Kirby. It's paced incredibly well despite its length. And yeah, it is a lengthy, dense-ass comic. But man, what amazing payoff, as Todd pointed out. We get great payoff for something that's been building since Namor's first reappearance into the universe. So this is a big one. This is one that changes everything for Namor and the Fantastic Four and for the Marvel Universe, honestly. So, yeah, you got to give it to Fantastic Four Annual number 1, best issue of 1963.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that, you know, last episode when we did 61 to 62, we each came with a different, you know, top issue of the year. And this time we all said it's either one of these two and, you know, kind of picked from that. So it's interesting to me that we all, you know, were kind of on the same page this time out as to where we were last time. Well, with all that being said, ladies and gentlemen, this brings an end to the second episode of the Marvel Age podcast covering 1963 in Marvel's publishing history. We hope you have enjoyed the ride. We are, of course, the Sarcastic Four. Before we get out of here, let's give everybody an opportunity to plug some of their stuff, let you know where we can be found on social media. So let's start it off with Russell, who was recently, once again, the first guest on the official Marvel Age spinoff show, Marvel Age Masterclass, with former editorial director of digital media for Marvel Entertainment, Ben Morse. Russell, got anything to plug? And can you tell people where to find you on the Twitter and Facebook machines, respectively?
On the Twitter machine, you can find me at Russell_Sellers. Tweet at me how wrong I am about all of my comics opinions. I love hearing that shit. Mm-hmm. And you can also find me on the Place to Be Nation comics Facebook group. I'm in there pretty periodically talking shop with as many folks as possible. Love hearing anybody's opinions in there. Join up. We'll let you in. It's fun times. Just did another episode of my own show, Seller's Points, with friends James Eccles and the host of the Sunday Groove, Mr.
Easy Like David Sunday.
Easy Like David Sunday.
Thank you.
As we will now forever refer to it. Mm-hmm. And we talked all things Image Comics, which is something that we hadn't really gotten to on that show lately. So between those and then some, of course, this podcast, the Marvel Age podcast, this is the number one. Listen to this. Yeah, that's about it for me for the time being, but I'm sure I'll be popping up in other places along the way.
Absolutely. Todd, what about you? What you got going on out there, and where can people find you on the social media?
Well, I remain the esteemed manager of the hard-traveling fanboys, who are the longest-running weekly
episodic
comic book podcast.
You got to work on that.
I was laughing at how fast you jumped in.
Oh, I'm trained. I am like Pavlov's dog at this point. Like, that's all I need to hear is longest-running, and I'm ready to go. You ought to see me watching an episode of Raw. Whenever Michael Cole jumps into longest-running, here I am ready to go with him. But, you know, that's just me.
And I produce and manage that show. I manage Sellers Points, Easy Like David Sunday, Talkin' Pop here on the Place to Be Nation Pop feed, among other shows, PTBN Play. Uh-huh. And this show, I also have my own show called Conversation Comics, currently on a hiatus, but hopefully we will be soon returning to the airwaves, especially with the establishment of my new podcast studio, which is not in the middle of my house, but on the far end of my house here at my summer residence.
And see, you just got to get you a podcasting studio in Ho Ho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Yes. And then you don't have to worry about anything, clearly.
And then maybe Todd, we can also get to that final metal blast that we've
got. Oh, right. Yeah, we do. We need to finish that.
Why bother? Anyway, Tim, no. Tim, your thoughts on
Nick didn't like
no
he does not.
No offense to you guys as podcasters, just why bother? Tim, where can people find you on the social media, and what do you have out there on the internet right now?
Okay, on the social media, you can find me at Psyche68 on Twitter. That's at CYKE68. People get mad at me if I don't spell it out, as I've been told. So that's Twitter. Hit me up. Yeah, much like Russell, tell me all the things I got wrong factually and opinion-wise on this show and in life, because I'm wrong about a lot of things. And I know that is a strange way to end that sentence, but that's how I'm going to do it. Also, on Place to Be Nation Pop, the aforementioned and Haffy Award-winning, sometimes Welpy Award winning, Talkin' Pop, myself and Jennifer Smith.
Jennifer Smith, AKA Easy Like Jenny Sunday.
So I will let Jenny
hear that.
Fire back with that. I'm sure she will have some choice words that I cannot wait to hear and that I will not take out of her mouth.
Bitch, there ain't nothing easy about me.
So we will have a June episode. I don't know what our topic will be yet, but I'm sure we will have a June episode that you can look forward to on Place to Be Nation. Boop! And on Place to Be Nation Wrestling, look for my monthly gig, WCW Survey Says. It's a retrospective of all the insanity from the world of WCW with my co-host Andy Helene. We'll have a, let's just call it a summertime-themed edition of Survey Says for the month of June with our guest, Jordan Duncan.
There you go. There you go. Good to hear, sir. And I, am, of course, Nick Duke. You can find me on Twitter at NickDuke87. Much like my compatriots, I am, of course, a frequent participant over on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. I also, here at Place to Be Nation, am one half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys who own and operate the two-time, Haffy Award-winning, longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation, the Hard Traveling Fanboys. So look out for us over there. Nice attempt, Todd, on the trip up. I went fast to prevent you from doing that this time. But in any event, thank you guys for listening so much. Let us know your feedback. If you want to hit any of us up with feedback on Facebook, on Twitter, at the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, if you have any comments you'd like to give, I think we could possibly work in some listener feedback into the show, perhaps read some comments or questions on air, and make this god-awfully long podcast even longer, if that's what you guys want to hear. So, with all that being said, a big thank you to all of you for listening. We hope you stick with us, and be sure to stay tuned to Place to Be Nation Pop, as the next thing coming from the Marvel Age brand should be Ben Morris's second episode of Marvel Age Masterclass as he reacts to this episode that you've just listened to. So go out there and look for it, and look for us coming with episode 3 covering 1964 sooner rather than later. Thanks again for listening, and have a great night.
Tony Stark makes you feel he's a cool exec.